Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts, with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, brand new pins, socks, and shirts for Pet Cemetery, as well as the two new pins and socks for the Warriors. Warriors! Sometimes accessories are better. Can you dig it? Stay tuned next Tuesday, August 27th, as Fright Rags celebrates the 45th anniversary of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, with two brand new t-shirt designs also available as a hoodie or a baseball tee. Listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10, and our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10. And welcome back to the Elric and Rebecca Horror Hour.
Elric and Rebecca Horror Hour.
Where everything's spooky. That is our new show. We have rebranded.
I know it's going to be really lame.
Shocking to Rob as he listens on a plane coming back here. He's going to be like, what? I've been cut out. Welcome.
Everything's going to be either be really highbrow or really lowbrow. There's nothing in between whatsoever.
Actually, I think our show would be Deep Cuts.
Deep Cuts.
Deep Cuts with Beck and Kane.
That's it.
No, you've returned to Shockwaves. Rob is still in Paris. And Ryan is still saving the Halloween franchise. And we're here alone.
Yeah.
Except with Ernie.
Well, Ernie's here with us. Hi, Ernie.
Hey.
Unlike Rob, I have no idea what episode number this is.
None. We don't pay attention to things like
that.
That's a Rob thing that he would pay attention to. But we do have a really exciting show planned because Elric and I wanted to do something a little bit different since it's just the two of us. And so we are going to count down.
Nude bowling. It's going to be easy, hard to describe.
It's not going to be as fun on air. But anyways, we're going to count down the films coming up in the remainder of 2020 that we are most looking forward to. And then we have two really fantastic guests, both of whom we've discussed on their work, their authors. We've discussed their work on the show previously, and they are coming on to join us in the second half, and we're going to be discussing lesser-known horror literary adaptations.
Yeah, which was their choice. And they are our listeners, and they've been discussed a lot on the show, and they just happen to be in town. So we might have had a second week off had they not been in town, but that's why you're getting this episode before
everyone's back. And it's going to rock, because Elric and I watched a lot of stuff together week in prep.
We watched quite a bit of new stuff. So let's kick off with the first one we saw together, which had probably just played a week ago, Scary Stories to Tell Alone in the Dark.
It's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Oh, what about Alone?
That's not in there.
Oh, I like that one more. Can that be a movie?
We went to see this on opening night and... yeah. You know, I appreciate a lot of what they did. And I've seen, I at first I felt bad when I was like, I don't know if I enjoyed that.
This is the director Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Which I love.
We both love. But this was a surprise because usually I don't remember going to even bad movies with you. Usually you turn and go, oh, that was great. But I remember, I was surprised. I actually thought you might have turned around and gone, oh, that was great. But your reaction was very like, eh.
Yeah.
But and that's because you also read these books a lot, and I did not.
Yeah, and I do have to say that probably colored my perception of this movie a bit, is these books were my childhood. Mm-hmm. Like, I still have my copies, and there's pages falling out of them, and places where my mom taped the pages back in, and I can remember the stories vividly. And so this was probably one of my most anticipated movies of the year. And it did not do what I wanted it to do. For me, it felt like it was riding this line between being an extreme horror film, like doing actually like really scary stuff and getting really, really psychological and dealing with adult issues. Like, for some reason, it was set against the backdrop of Vietnam. The books are not. I'm not too sure why that choice was made.
Right. You said that afterwards, and it was interesting to me because I'm watching it not knowing what time period the books were actually set in or where they came out.
Like all different.
So my brain just instantly went, oh, I bet they were set in this period. So I just accepted that. I didn't know either. I have read a couple things post after you saying like why this period. I saw somebody commenting that they thought it was something kind of to make an allusion to like kids disappearing in Vietnam, they disappear and never come back. And here, people are just disappearing from the narrative. So, I mean, there's links. It's not, they're not
hitting
hard.
That's a cool link.
Yeah.
They didn't hit that hard enough for me to get it.
Yeah, no, I didn't see it when I was watching.
I was really trying, too.
Well, and it definitely wasn't subtle because they were playing up Nixon a lot. They kept saying Nixon,
they kept playing Nixon through the whole thing. We were watching news footage and we were watching election footage. And they were kind of doing this hippie versus normies thing. And then there was the out-of-town non-white person who rolled in that they were definitely playing with as well. Like, there was a lot going on, but I don't know why. Unless it was just to be like, you know, things are weird right now. Look how it was like this in the 60s too. Like, it just didn't do it for me. And then the movie itself was riding a line between being like a true horror film about adult issues, very much like It, where it's kids dealing with adult issues, being forced to grow up and dealing with this super fucking hyper scary shit, and it being a Goosebumps movie. And it was really riding the line back and forth between the two. And it never felt comfortably in either. And so it never really, I don't know who the audience was.
Yeah, sure. Never felt like a kid's film to me. Like, I mean, like in terms of like, I've heard people say, oh, it's meant for young horror. But I was like, yeah, but it's pretty intense for that. And the creature, you know, my feeling overall is I actually enjoyed it. Like, I had fun. I think I thought the first half was really good. I think the first 30 minutes and there's a scarecrow that I loved all of them.
Oh, the Harold story, which is one of the only stories that was part.
Well, definitely the pimple.
The pimple was part, Harold was part, and then the other two are very, very loosely.
Yeah.
Like the woman that you run into in the hallway, that image, like even the shape of her face and everything, is from the books, but not the way that she's performing or delivering or
it
the heart.
Is the one about eating a toe or a finger in it?
That is in there.
I like that one too. I think but the second half, even though there's a really cool creature designed in the second
Jangly
half,
Man is not in there.
Yeah, it's a cool creature though. It becomes, I felt like, quite generic in the second half, and it starts to kind of rush towards its goal at the end. And where it was really easy to kill characters in the first parts of the story, suddenly you can run away from them and get away pretty easily. And it's, for me, that was a little convenient.
And I really enjoyed the Jangly Man as a character. And I will say they were trying to link him to the stories because he kept saying Mi Tai Doty Walker over and over, which is from the original stories. But in it, it's just a head that follows him around. But I actually enjoyed him as a character, how he could like rotate himself and his movement and kind of the biology of him I thought was cool. It just didn't congeal for me.
But the narrative, and the character. I mean, the characters are definitely fairly stock. I do know that Rob, like obviously I'll talk about it when he's back, but he was one of the first really negative reviews I saw out there. I thought most people were actually very pretty positive about the movie. I remember seeing, I think he gave it like 2 stars and was talking about how visual effects will never be scary. You know, CGI is never scary. And then when I was watching, I didn't notice much besides the was, is just like some
the hall thing,
which isn't very interesting. But most of the creatures themselves all looked pretty badass to me.
I didn't think the
level.
Pimple looked very good.
Yeah,
but
maybe. But I liked it. I definitely didn't love it. There's parts I thought were really interesting. I can see why if I was 12 or 13, I might think it's really badass in terms of the stories. But So that was, probably won't be Shockwaves approved, but it still shows that director obviously knows how to create atmosphere because that's what it's rich on.
And there were parts of it that I was like, this is a great jump scare. The toe scene, the toe completely.
No, that was really
I
good.
Loved that one.
Yeah. So. I think also they're limited because you just have this group of people and now they're the ones who have to be picked off and you can't go outside that bubble too much. Anyway, then we saw, well, obviously you saw.
I saw 47 Meters Down, Uncaged, which I drug Elric along with me too as well.
And I rather like the first one. It's fun. Like, it's not as good as Shallows, but it's like a fun shark film. We know Johannes, obviously, he's been on the show. He, you know, directed one of the greatest scenes ever in a slasher movie in Strangers 2, pool scene.
I love that scene so much.
I never get tired.
I use it in my class to show a perfect murder set piece because it is just such
Except
a beautiful construction.
They don't kill
I know.
It ruins that. It's the only thing. If you cut it off before, you're like, that's fine. But because he keeps living and then he just dies later, you're like, what was the point of not dying there? It's stupid. Anyway, but the scene, I mean, that's the writing is the problem, not the scene. So this 47 Meters, let's hear your thoughts.
So 47 Meters Down, Uncaged. Not as clever as the first one. And it definitely had some flaws for me.
How about not clever at all? Should we just say not clever?
I had fun with it.
Of course, well, you can have fun at a movie without it being clever.
Yeah, it was fun though. But I did like that they were trying to mix it up. I mean, how often the idea of setting a shark movie in an underground forgotten temple, ancient temple cave thing.
All cool. The characters who go to said cave, not cool.
Yeah.
Lame, like high school, generic, just like... It really, I mean, the one thing I'll say, I think there is some of the worst character setup I think I've ever seen in a movie in terms of like these stock, hi, I'm a stock teenage girl, I'm a stock cool teenage girl, and now we're all like just randomly swimming and, oh, look at all this like really high tech equipment just laid out for us. It's like, what?
It was left on a dock. Let's just use it and go scuba diving.
Wait, there's the guy from Northern Exposure. Hey, Dad. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the actual cave is cool, and the idea of like
it's a blind albino shark.
That's
like
cool.
Meandering around. No, and once they were in the cave, I was in, but there was definitely a driving sequence where they were like singing along and, oh, we're such free spirits. And I leaned over to Elric and was like, this has 10 more minutes to impress me.
Yeah. And it didn't feel like music for now. It felt very much like, I wonder what teenage girls are like. Let's try writing them, me and my guy friend. And it felt very distant for me once they got in there.
As soon as they were in the cave, I loved it. And I have to say, I like the ending of this one, how it played out in the last 15 minutes. It's better than the first one.
Yeah, we'll say 2 second spoilers. It's just that there's a scene towards the end where they're surrounded by stuff. I won't totally ruin it, but if that had been the 20 minute mark and you had to survive the rest of that movie from that moment, I think it would have been the greatest idea. Kind of open
water. Yeah.
I agree. I think the ending is really, but it also gets so bonkers by the end that it's a kind of funny in a way. But
oh my God, when it goes to slow motion like stuff, action style, like Johannes knew what he was doing for lot of it, especially with the sharks as well. And
it's weird that they downgrade the cast and stuff. Like, it's a strange thing to me because the first one made a lot of money, did really well,
and was only the two casts. This is a huge
and Matthew
cast.
Modine as the as the boat guy, and now they've called the school in this one Modine University, which I thought was is a thing. and no one besides the Northern Exposure guy, John Corbett, were really people you'd recognize, which is like, you know, fine on horror films, you don't need to, but it seemed a little bit like it would have been the straight to video version of that idea. It was fun.
I'm glad we had fun.
Yeah, it was cool.
I still ate popcorn and jumped when the sharks came out. And
it's
everything.
Still better than one we didn't get to see together that we tried to a few weeks ago that I finally caught up last night, which is The Curse of La Llorona.
La Llorona.
La Llorona. It is.
Are we saying that right? No, Ernie says we're not.
Ernie said we are.
Ernie, how are we saying?
You should say it.
Yeah.
Llorona.
Llorona.
So it's like a J? Or
it feels like it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So Lorna. The Curse of Lorna. It's not good. It's interesting. This is the protege that James Wan. It's not bad. It's not like a bad movie by any means. It's like perfectly competent, but at no point does it have that extra gear where you see that thing. It's interesting because they're like, the guy had done a short that my friend Dick showed me, which is a really good short, and clearly has been picked from that short to be protege because he made this and he was already signed to do Conjuring 3.
So he is
the guy taking over. And I kind of wanted to tweet afterwards. I didn't. I was just like, we really wish this guy would watch some Evil Dead or something that's a little messier. It's so clean all the time. And she's constantly, the spirit is constantly like screaming and jump scaring at you. And you never jump. I never jumped in a theater. I'm sure it played a lot better. It's a ghost who killed her. I guess she got jealous of her husband. This is in the past, and then drowned her two children.
It's a very famous.
Yeah. And there's been many straight to video versions of this story.
Actually, the first one, there was one in the 1920s from Mexico. It's the La Llorona. La Llorona. Yeah. She's really cool looking. She's really cool looking in it in the 1920s.
This version looks pretty good too. There's a couple good sequences. Like I said, there's a part in a bathtub where you see the hands are creepier than the hole. Mm-hmm. But there's just something about there. I hate to say because the actress whose name I've forgotten, but she's from Scooby Doo and Freaks and Geeks, and she's a great actress. Big fan of hers. Her name slipped my mind, but. In this, every beat with the kids I don't buy for a second that she's their mom. Like, it's like she comes home and you hear somebody crying upstairs, like the little girl, and she takes forever to walk up to find out. Like, it's all done for tension. And I'm like, if your daughter's crying and you walk home, you walk straight to them and go, are you okay? Like, there's so many beats like that felt They didn't get really the psychology. Oh, yeah, that is
from 1933.
Ooh, I need to see that now.
La Llorona. It's a Mexican
horror
film.
Oh, I really want to see it. It's really cool.
It's really good.
I'll have to double feature that. You know, it's an interesting story, but it becomes very generic possession. You know, here comes the priest to help us. It's trying to take our kids, you know, in the house. I think people, it's just one of those things that with a couple steps to the left, it can become Conjuring, and a couple steps to right, it's The Nun, you know, and this one's somewhere, it's closer, definitely closer than Nun. It's similar in a way. I think Nun actually had some better atmosphere, even though the film as a whole didn't work.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know I'm probably telling a population who've already seen it. It flatlined for me a little bit. Hopefully The Conjuring will be, Conjuring 3 will be better.
Yeah, excited for that one. And Autopsy of Jane Doe, I think, was my number one three years ago. So, yeah. I have to give him credit. This was recommended by Mike Williamson while we were sitting at the pool while our kids took swim lessons.
But we've talked about the Mangler here before.
No, this is not Mangler.
Oh, Freddy, you've talked about Freddy 5 tons of times.
He recommends other movies.
Wait, besides those two?
So. He recommended, cause we were talking about Stuart Gordon, and I was like, if we just don't get any good Lovecraft films, and at the time I had just done the Lovecraft episode on, The Greatest Movie Never Made. So we were talking about that, and then it led into him saying, have you ever seen Stuck? And I was like, I don't think so. And he was like, it's not a Lovecraft film in any way. It's like Stuart Gordon made a made-for-TV movie kind of Lifetime-y, but it's really good. And so it's on Amazon Prime. And it's really good.
Yeah.
I had so much fun with that. Based on a true story, Mina Savari plays a nurse who really likes to party and drugs and drinking. And on her way home from the club one night, she hits a homeless man who they definitely make sure you feel is the most sweet, angelic, most wonderful homeless man ever. But I mean, he's really down on his luck, and she hits him and he goes crashing through her windshield and gets stuck there and can't move because his legs are broken. And she drives home, parks the car in the garage. He's still very conscious, but bleeding out. And she says, I'll go call help. And then she goes inside, does nothing, has sex with her boyfriend, takes some more drugs. And then eventually she tells her boyfriend that there's a guy stuck to her car in the garage whose legs are broken and can't move. And in which case it completely goes off the rails, where they're arguing whether or not to kill him. You know, what's going to happen to the car? Now her car is covered in blood. She can't take it anywhere to get repaired. Like, she's going to lose her car. Do they call the cops? Him saying, oh no, it's just a homeless person. And in the meantime, this guy's like, I'm still alive. I'm still here. Days go by. And then ultimately, I won't say where it goes, but it just gets completely fucking bonkers. And apparently Stuart took it in a different direction than the actual event. But I had so much fun with it. I was homesick one evening when I was watching this, and it just perked me up. And it's a bleak movie,
I think he's always funny, though. Stuart Gordon always has humor to what he does.
That's the weird thing.
Even Edmund,
which
is bleak as hell.
Yeah, this incredibly dark subject matter, especially when you find out that it's real. And it is very much kind of performed and delivered like a Lifetime movie. Yeah. But at the same time, it was just, this is so sleazy. I'm just having fun with this.
I saw it when it first came out. I don't remember all of it, but I remember liking it.
Yeah. So that is Stuck from Stuart Gordon in 2007. Sorry.
Nice. The other one I saw, so this is for LA-based people. You should know that the Alamo Drafthouse has this thing called Video Vortex with their 40,000 film library that is all free. And the reason it's relevant is I have a list of films that I look for all the time and can never find anywhere online or in video stores. And one of them is a film that Jackson Stewart, who made Beyond the Gates, he recommended me about a year and a half ago on a Pure Cinema episode. And I've been looking for it ever since. I let you know I love Fulci. There's one of his films I'd never been able to find called Sweet House of Horrors, which is kind of in his late, at the very end period, almost might have even been TV movie, has that feeling. And he was always like, no, that one's really good. It is utterly bonkers, even by Fulci standards. This movie, it opens with pure Fulci.
What's it called? One more time.
Sweet House of Horror. And so this video store has it on DVD. It's a long out of print title, and I rented it for free. So heads up if that's your jam. It basically opens with a couple coming home to their nice mansion, and they're laughing, and they realize that there had been, just before them, there had been a guy breaking into their safe. And when he sees that they've come home, instead of trying to, he knocks over a plant and realizes, oh, I've got to brutally murder them. And it is total Fulci, total pushing the gore, pushing the violence. It feels like you're watching Last House on the Left for
nice.
For about 10 minutes. And then their kids had been away at a camp. So the kids, and then we open the rest of the movie, and suddenly it goes and becomes basically a kids movie for the next hour, where kids come home from camp, little kids, and their auntie and uncle are looking after them and talking about, oh, it's so sad what's happened. The kids start seeing the ghosts of their parents who kind of are trying to play with them. So the uncle and aunt think they're crazy. And basically they start to play tricks on people in the house. The kids do. They're being kind of naughty. So the tone goes from utter gore fest, violent, to kind of weird haunted kids movie, very goosebumpy, to basically utterly bananas by the end, when we start to realize it could also be a malevolent present going on. It is unlike any movie I have seen. It freeze frames on some ridiculous stuff at the end. Highly recommend it if you have that Fulci craving. I don't want to ruin, like, you know, all the goofy stuff that happens in between. But it is. I don't think I've ever seen a film that starts that violent. It'd be like starting with New York Ripper and then going into some sort of kids movie.
So when do they have sex with saxophones?
They don't, but luckily the kids don't.
That's weird.
That's weird.
Yeah, now, Rick,
we don't need kids.
Don't go there.
We don't. Hey, I'm pretty sure you went there. Pretty sure there's an audio record of it.
Well, I'll run through some of these other ones pretty quick. I watched Sister Street Fighter, which I had not seen before, but I had the fancy air release, and I know Agfa's been doing some screenings of it. They did one at UCLA a couple of weeks ago. It's just awesome. I'd never seen this one before, and I've actually, there used to be on Sunday mornings where I grew up, we had this thing called the Sunday Morning Kung Fu Theater. And so I watched a ridiculous amount of kung fu films growing up, so I can recognize most of the players. This one has Sonny Chiba in it. But yeah, this one, it's fun. It's just a fun film about a sister who is trying to hunt down her brother. It's not a nun.
She's an actual sister.
She's an actual sister.
I thought
sister.
It was like sister.
So did I. And they kind of dress her to look like that. Like, she definitely is wearing kind of nun colors through much of it. But no, she is a sister, and her brother has gone missing. And so she's kind of fighting her way through the local gangs to save him. And apparently it's a whole series, so I now have to hunt down the next three.
Okay.
But that was fun, from 1974. Just a super fun viewing. And then I watched one called Searching that I'd had on my list for a long time.
I heard great things about that. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I can't call it a horror film exactly. But if you liked Unfriended, definitely check this out. Because after Unfriended, I saw there was kind of a small little boom of films that took place entirely on laptop. Screen grab ones. And I did not see any others besides Unfriended that I liked. And I thought Unfriended was great. I hated it when I first heard about it. I remember being like, oh, it's Facebook, the movie.
Did you see the second one? I never saw Dark Web.
Which one? Dark Web, the TV show?
No, Unfriended Dark Web is the second
one. I never saw the second one. I need to.
Yeah, I think I heard it wasn't supernatural, so it made me less interested.
Oh, yeah, that makes me less interested. Yeah. Well, this is not supernatural. This is, it, but it's in that same vein, and this is the only other screen grab movie that I've been completely captivated by.
Oh, it's a missing child film, right?
Yeah, it's a missing child. So it's a gentleman, his daughter doesn't come home. She's a senior in high school. She doesn't come home from school one day, and none of her friends have a clue where she is. And what he discovers really quickly is none of her friends know her in the same regard that her dad does. So her dad thinks she's like this straight edge student who plays piano and goes to lessons all the time and would never do anything wrong. And her friends are like, I haven't hung out with her in over a year. I don't know what she's doing. And then he finds out
that dude has not seen Euphoria.
She has, I know.
Watch Euphoria.
She has, he finds an alternate ID. He finds all of these different bank accounts. And so, and this is all online. And then it just kind of goes into the police are contacting him, so he's Skyping with the police, and it goes from there. And it's
John Cho as the actor,
and it's just a really well-paced movie.
Yeah.
And I won't call it horror, but it's definitely like missing child, suspected killer type thing. Directed by a USC graduate, Inesh Chaganti, and it came out in 2018.
I don't even think you have to say you. I mean, everyone's a USC graduate at this point who makes movies.
Well,
NYU.
I'm proud to work there, so I say. USC graduate, Inesh Chaganti. So.
I can't talk. I'm wearing a t-shirt of my branded
school. Yes,
right
you
now.
Are.
Accidentally. Any others before we do our five what we're looking for?
I watched Perdita Durango again.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm doing some work with Severin on the fancy Blu-ray that's coming up. But I will save that for another night because that's a giant can of worms.
Better version of that? Like, did you watch their?
I have. I'm excited. I have not seen theirs yet. Okay. I am excited for whatever they do with it. Because I have the DVD that was released in 1997 under that's the Dance with the Devil titling.
And oh, that's what you called it in America. I saw that the Perdita Durango New Zealand long.
It's super censored. The one that we had released here in America has about 10 minutes cut out of it.
Oh, okay. I've never seen that.
Including, it's mostly a lot of the scenes with the voodoo, some of the sex stuff, a lot of boobs. I mean, because there's lots of them throughout the movie.
Don't cut boobs.
I know. But I mean, the movie itself, I can't call it a fun film. That's what I was trying to, you know, write up my notes for.
The performances are fun.
The performances are amazing, and it's shot like a comedy, and it's presented like a comedy. It really, and I mean, it is a dark comedy, but at the same time, it is so dark. So, but I will save that for another night when the Blu-ray comes out and I'm talking about it. So, yay.
That's one of those movies that it left a big impression. I don't think I had seen Javier Bardem in something before that. And so
he
he
had done a bunch of Spanish films.
I'm sure.
He had not done, this was kind of his first English speaking film.
Yeah.
And he is gorgeous in this movie, which is weird to say because he's like soulless, but he is gorgeous in this movie.
Yeah. But I like that. And I'm looking forward to it. It's Barry Gifford is the writer who obviously co-wrote Lost Highway with David Lynch.
And based on real characters. So,
yeah, the Wendy and Sailor.
Lula,
yeah, and Sailor, novel by Barry Gifford, which became Wild at Heart.
And Perdita Durango was based on a Mexican high priestess called the High Priestess of Blood. I think her name was Magdalena, and then she like ran this cult. And then Romeo, who was played by Javier Bardem, was based off of like this brutal drug runner who believed he could like hypnotize the border agents to get through. Supposedly, this is all great hearsay, but it makes for a hell of a story.
Yeah, I love that it's getting a release though. So
long overdue.
I look forward to that. Okay.
So what five films are you looking forward to?
Yeah, so this was fun. I mean, for me, I haven't first, I don't know, is Ready or Not on your list? It's not on my list.
It is on my list, okay, but I mean, we're seeing that on Tuesday.
We're seeing it soon.
I made a list of like 12 films to see how I feel on the day.
But I am super excited. That's not on my list, but I'm just saying it's coming out very soon. Probably by the time you hear this, it might almost be out. Super excited. I totally believe
everyone. We're seeing it next Tuesday.
Who I would trust, I believe, has said it's freaking awesome, so can't wait. Okay, so I have five that you know that won't surprise people probably. First one is Jeremy Gardner's follow-up to The Battery. I have heard about the script for quite a few years, never read it because I was, you know, hoping he'd get it made. He got it made. It's a love story / creature feature in a house, which is ticks a lot of my favorite things. I don't want to know more than that. I just want to see
it. I've seen the last, like the third act.
Oh, why would you watch the end of it?
Because, Lawson showed it. David Lawson, the producer, came into my USC class when I was teaching a lesson on jump scares. And so he showed probably the last 20 minutes of it.
Why would you show the end, Lawson?
Because I wanted to see it, and it had a good jump scare.
Show the first one. Anyway, I'm very excited about that. I hear Bria Grant's really good in it, and Jeremy's in it. So that's one definitely super excited.
Excellent. Okay, so mine at number five is, I'm going to go with Black Christmas. Just because...
Will that be this year? I don't.
December 13th is when it's slated for. This is Sofia Tikal, who we've had on the show before when she did her Into the Dark series. And being written by April Wolf, who I've been on her show before, and she's just wonderful. And essentially, when I look back at my favorite slashers, and you know, I'm not exactly a slasher person. Like, I'd still rather watch it to anything else the majority of the time. But
you can listen to a 4-hour episode of Screen Draft where we debate every single
Friday
13th.
All of the
Friday
the 13th. And I even say there, I will watch slashers than like a comedy any day of the week, but it's not out of the horror genre. Slashers are not my favorite subgenre. But that said, I fucking love Black Christmas, and I always have. I don't even mind the remake.
Yeah,
I mean,
the remake's fun.
Yeah, it's completely fun. And so I'm excited to see what they can do with it.
Well, I did hear, I don't think she'd seen it before. Like it was pitched to her, and then she had. So that's fascinating because usually it's somebody who's really in love with a movie. So I will. I've liked her films. Mm-hmm. I've liked parts of all her films. I have yet to like love one. I think one called Green, which was a little earlier. I liked the atmosphere in that. So, they're also kind of usually like, you know, realistic types of characters. So I'll be curious how she brings that in. So yeah definitely curious. My next one is, anytime Larry Fessenden has a new film, I am celebrating. I am very excited to Depraved is his Frankenstein.
Coming up in just a bit.
It's really soon. Hopefully I'll get to see it on a screen. I don't know if it's IFC Midnight. It probably is. Or maybe it's Yellowvale.
It's Yellowvale.
Yeah, I don't know much about his interpretation. I know he early on in his career made that kind of Frankenstein movie before he even made Habit, or right around there he made a kind of a version of that on video, I believe. But anytime Larry makes something, count me in, and I'm hearing good things. So Depraved.
So my number four is Dr. Sleep, which I'm assuming is on your list.
Yeah,
probably
we'll call it.
Dr. Sleep, follow-up to The Shining, directed by Mike Flanagan. It just received an R rating today from the MPAA for all types of crazy shit, but yeah.
I was avoiding trailers because until I started hearing about all The Shining.
Didn't
kind of
it run before some of the movies?
It might have, and then finally when I saw it, I was like, oh, hell yes, because when it shows those parts,
stuff he reshot.
It just looked so good. It really just brought it all back, my love of The Shining, and I haven't read the book because I wanted to, now it's going to be hard to, but it did sound like the book wasn't perfect. So maybe sometimes you can improve on certain things cinematically. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited. The only, I kind of wish E.T. was Elliot. I wish Elliot had grown up to be the actor in this because I think he looks so much like Danny.
Oh, wow.
I think he's in it, but he's not playing that character. Obviously, Ewan McGregor greenlights a movie better. But looking forward to that one. So that would have been my number three, we'll say, and your four. So now you can do your three.
So my three is Little Monsters.
I have not heard of it.
Have you not heard? Okay, it's a British horror film coming up. I believe it's British Australian. And it stars Lupita, I'm going to say her name wrong.
Nyong'o.
Who plays a kindergarten teacher. And she's just the most bubbly kindergarten teacher with a ukulele in a bright yellow dress. She teaches kindergarten, taking her kindergartners to a farm as a zoo. It's kind of like a farm zoo, petting zoo type thing on the day of a zombie outbreak.
Oh.
And she keeps them together as a class and how she does it and working with the people who are still alive. It's very comic. It's British. It's a British Australian horror comedy and it's extremely comedic, over the top. Watch the trailer. It's just the trailer is so fun.
She's having a good year in horror.
Yeah. And you know how much I love horror comedy and British. This is, I believe, a British Australian co-production.
Can it also be a musical?
It feels like it could be because there's moments that she pulls the ukulele out and you'll see even in the trailer, you'll see zombies running past in the background and they're on this hay wagon and they can't get off because there's zombies all around them. And she's like, and if you're happy and you know it, trying to get them to sing along so they don't pay attention. And
so it could be the Becca trifecta, almost.
It looks wonderful. I'm really excited to see it. So, Little Monsters. And that is due out November 15th, directed by Abe Forsyth.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that one. My number two that I'm looking forward to is these weren't really ranked, but longtime great producer, had been a guest on Killer PV, Travis Stevens. His first foray into directing, which has already played a bunch of festivals, but not to us yet, hopefully Beyond Fest, A Girl on the Third Floor, is obviously a ghost story set in a house that they're renovating. Beyond that, I don't know much. I haven't seen a trailer. I know it has CM Punk in the lead role. It's getting good reviews. It sounds like it's pretty intense. And what I thought might have just been a foray into putting his foot into making a film, kind of having as a change-up, sounds like it's not a change-up. Sounds like this is – I saw a post from him yesterday saying he's already got the next one that he's going to direct and said after doing all this producing – this is what he's doing now. I mean, it doesn't mean he's not producing too, but
yeah.
I'm excited for him and excited about this movie. So, and I want to know as little about it as possible before I see it. I've been a big fan of a lot of the stuff he's produced over the years. So very cool. Travis, well done.
So my number one that I am just dying to see is
that'll be your two.
No.
Really?
It's my
didn't you start?
Oh, I put Ready or Not on my list and then took it off.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well then now I'm completely out of order because I would have put this. I'm going to say this is a Netflix one I keep hearing about, In Tall Grass. Stephen King and Joe Hill with Vincenzo Natali directing.
Oh.
Yeah. And I've been hearing snippets about it. That one sounds really good.
Weird. I haven't heard. I mean, I love Vincenzo. He's a really cool dude too.
Yeah, I love.
Had him all the way back on, like when I was doing This Week in Horror. I'm not sure if I ever brought him back on Inside Horror, but he's a really. I think he's a really talented director, and he knows so much about. Like he's one of the best Shining experts out there.
Really?
I've heard him talk on the projection booth about Shining, and it was fantastic. Uh-huh. So, yeah, do you know what the idea is?
Netflix? Uh-huh. Just because I am slightly familiar with the story, it is literally about a girl who is walking, if I remember correct, it's been a while since I read the synopsis of it, but someone is walking through this like crazy tall grass and hears people hollering from inside, like somebody calling for help. And somebody goes into the tall grass to see what it is, and they just disappear into nothingness. And every single person who goes into this tall grass just disappears into nothingness.
So sci-fi horror, maybe?
Yeah, I'm guessing.
And Natalie's kind of known for
that's
sci-fi.
That's kind of his jam, crossover. With like Splice and, so.
Cube? Yeah, Cube. Cool. Well, the one I'm actually going to mention one more after this, but the one I'm most, by far, the film I most want to see this year, if I could beam it into my eyeballs, is Robert Eggers' follow-up to The Witch, The Lighthouse.
That's my number one.
Okay, boom. I only needed to see the monochromatic still of this movie, and that it was what I heard from out of Cannes when this played out of competition. So it was just played as a test screening, in a sense. People said, had this been in competition, it might have won. That's how lavish the praise was for it. It's one of those films where I have no idea what the story is going to be.
As soon as it's Lighthouse and Ghosts and two dudes, I'm kind of, and one of them's Robert Pattinson.
And the other one's Willem Dafoe, and they're both hairy.
Love, yeah. I just, the whole concept of this, and there's, I love Lighthouse movies. I think there's the one, that I've plugged on the show so many times is like this amazing deep
Coldskin?
Cut. No, 19, Coldskin I was just okay with.
I've read the book, but I haven't seen the movie.
The movie, Coldskin. I mean, the effects kind of killed it for me, but
reading that, I was like, I don't know how the hell you're going to do this.
Cause it's so many fishy people walking around land on broad day.
And the guy's having sex with the fish girl.
Right?
So
it's weird.
Film that?
They film it and, he does have sex with her, but there's one from 1999 called Dead of Night, aka I think it's also called The Lighthouse. So this is the one I've talked about on the show many times, but no one watches it.
Well, there's a lot of films called Dead of Night, though.
Well, that's why I always go with The Lighthouse. Yeah. And it's about a prison ship that is transporting a group of absolutely vicious prisoners when the ship runs aground. And this is during a war. I want to say World War One. It may be a different one. But the prison ship runs onto a bunch of rocks. Everything gets thrown open. They open all the cage, the cells and everything to let everybody out. And then a small group of survivors wash up on this nearby lighthouse, one of them being this vicious serial killer named the Headhunter, who starts picking off. And so the doctors, the nurses, and the prison wardens and the prisoners all have to try to work together against this Headhunter dude, who's literally like a serial killer marching around the island taking off people's heads. It's great.
You made that shit up.
It's awesome.
That just came off the top of your head right now. You
right
just
now,
made that
just
up.
That.
It's not a movie.
It is. But no, and that's the only other one that I can look at and go, Lighthouse Horror, it's great. I mean, the end of Annihilation and The Lighthouse,
great. And The Fog has a great moment.
Yeah, The Fog.
Lighthouses are just inherently, because they don't feel like they're part of modern society at all, but they were actually, you know, a necessity. And so
I feel like they're still used.
I guess. I mean, they're definitely landmarks that get visited. I don't know. But I think they're fascinating. But this idea that it's just a whole movie with these two guys at this lighthouse, it's like, I don't know where the story and drama is going to come from, but I am all about it. Apparently, it was a very hard shoot, so that usually means the movie's going to be good.
So that's my number one. And I mean, I love Robert Pattinson right now.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, after Good Time, he's
Good Time. That was
the most interesting actor working. That's what all the Batman stuff was just so stupid. It's like, he'll probably be the
best one
possible person.
But that bothered me so bad when people were saying that. But we never talk about our non-horror choices on this show. But last year, Good Time was my favorite film of the year.
He reminds me of DiCaprio in the sense that, he, it's awkward that you have to watch them grow up in movies that he's already in it, but his first thing was obviously Harry Potter, but then it was
Twilight.
No, but before he's in
Twilight.
Yeah, he's the friend. He's one of the guys, one of the competing sports guys in Harry Potter. And he dies. Spoiler.
Oh, he died.
Yep, they're all nodding.
Okay.
I saw it after I had seen Twilight. Don't get me wrong.
My daughter could fill you in on that. But, I'm not as up on my
But as soon as
Harry
Potter. You know, it's kind of like, I remember there's a great story about George Clooney doing the Batman movie. And when the Batman movie just tanked, No, it didn't tank, but when he, like, it was, you know, it made money, but no one liked it. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a great story where he said to his agent, "Where do we stand?" or his accountant, and his accountant just said, "You never have to do that again." And he's like, "All right, we won't." And that's where he became this really interesting actor. He started making great movies and working. Robert Pattinson, same thing. He made that Twilight money, and then he started working with Cronenberg, and he started working with really interesting directors. Yeah. And even though I think the ones with Cronenberg are just okay, because they're a little dull, they're like just the characters are a little dry. As soon, you know, once you see Good Time, High Life, there's no one who's been more interesting to watch. The one with the gold, The Lost City of Z, he's really good in that. Like,
I haven't seen that one.
He's great. He's not the lead, he's the second in it, and he's phenomenal. So yeah, I'm with you. I think Lighthouse will be great. The only other one I'm going to mention, it's not really a pick because it's such a obvious one, and if any human isn't looking forward to this, there's a little press about it today, Color of Space by Richard Stanley. And the guys, I suspect, of course, that has to be up there because who the hell knows what that's going to be. Like, it's impossible to know.
Well, there's also, I mean, It Chapter 2, which I'm looking forward to. That was like a given.
I guess, people started seeing it today and there's early word and it was mixed. And I was surprised by that because I'd heard early on that it was like, I think King or somebody had called it like a masterpiece. So I'm just curious. I'm not going to judge until I get to.
And then there's two that I wish I was excited for, but I'm just kind of like, maybe I'll see it. Zombieland 2.
It's maybe been too long for me. The problem is,
that's where I'm at.
When we just saw Jarmusch do a movie ripping off that movie,
which didn't do well.
Didn't do well, and doesn't make sense for him to really make that. And then there's another movie. It just feels maybe it's too close, but maybe it'll be great.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, you know what? I'll try it. Like, I tried the TV show on Amazon. They did the very.
I didn't even know there was.
It wasn't good. It was not. And I really wanted to like that. And that was years ago.
I guess it's impressive that they got all of the people back. That's hard. I mean, getting Emma Stone back must have been hard. So.
And then Jacob's Ladder. The reboot too. Yeah, that's another one where I'm like, I don't know. And I don't want to be that person that's like, but I really love the original, the original.
Well, it's also, that one's a movie of ideas. And
So I think I was burned on Flatliners.
Yeah.
And so.
You watched the remake?
I watched the remake because I love the original so much. So I was like, yeah, of course I'll watch the remake. Yeah. I was burned.
Yeah, I love the original, that one too.
Yeah.
So that's what we're looking forward to.
So yay.
Nick Cage in a H.P. Lovecraft movie. What could go wrong?
It's going to be awesome.
That's going to be freaking rad. Speaking of literary adaptations, dun, dun, dun. We will beam back in a second with our guest. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, brand new pins, socks, and shirts for Pet Cemetery, as well as the two new pins and socks for the Warriors. Warriors! Sometimes accessories are better. Can you dig it? Stay tuned next Tuesday, August 27th, as Fright Rags celebrates the 45th anniversary of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, with two brand new t-shirt designs also available as a hoodie or a baseball tee. Listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10, and our Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WAVES10. Again, that's 10% off by using code WAVES10. Okay, and we are back with for our dive into literary horror with Adam Caesar and Matt Serafini. Both guys we've known, at least I've known online a lot. I know Ryan has mentioned your work quite a bit lately. I feel like he's been diving into your book.
Well, both Ryan and I read Con Season and Video Night and
The one that I want to read, sorry, we're jumping in, but Summer Hours sounded like a hook that I could get behind, so I got to read that. And I feel like you wrote for, was it Dread for a long time?
Long time, like 10 years.
So that's where I know your name from originally.
I've talked to you online a bunch, I know.
Did
you do Fango as well?
A little bit.
Okay.
Just a little bit.
Because I swear I've been seeing your name pop up for like decades, so.
You're a lifer.
Decades!
I have, yes. Oh, it's been a long grind.
You're like 70.
So. I am. I look all right for 70.
But we heard that you guys were going to be in town together, no less, and we thought, why not? And we weren't even going to, I probably did say to you, we probably weren't even going to have an episode because we were waiting for Rob, but you guys are here together. I say, let's do it. And then, obviously we want to hear a little bit of insights into how you guys approach your books and like what that whole world is like, because I feel like the horror publishing world is really fascinating. We had Aaron, what's it, Aaron?
Aaron Dries.
Oh, yeah, Streisand.
The greatest.
That guy.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
love him.
Such a good dude. You know, on recently, and it's always been interesting to see, you know, his career, you know, he just, the consistency of putting books out is really impressive, I think, with everyone. But also we're going to get to talking about our favorite underrated or maybe underappreciated literary adaptations. We'll get to that in a sec.
All right.
So yeah, where do you want to start? Where, like, one thing I noticed from, like, both, it seems to be a love of, like, 80s horror slasher films from both years. Where does the horror begin for you? Just like us, I assume, the video store as kids?
I think we're both similar in the fact that we write more fun horror, or we started our careers writing things that are a little bit more would appeal to movie fans. Like, my first book was Tribesmen, which was the first to come out, and the first book I wrote was Video Night, and they're both kind of have this love of the world of film and film fandom, and I kind of, in a lot of my work, I kind of inject that in there and kind of love and sometimes frustration with film fandom. If you've read Con Season, you know it's not like all nice to horror fans, which is, I think I'm not a self-loathing horror fan, but I love horror movies so much, and I know that, like,
You enjoy taking the piss out of them a little bit.
Oh, yeah, and exactly. And yeah. And I think that's part of loving something, is acknowledging when you're not always loving it. But yeah, and I've in recent years kind of gotten away from it, just because I don't want to be a one trick pony. And as Elric said, where you're trying to put out books semi regularly, you know, always trying to build an audience. So my next book is not. I was like, oh, let me give myself a challenge. None of these characters like movies. None of these characters like horror movies. None of these characters are going to talk about horror movies. We're going to do a modern slasher where it is just kids in America now, like you were talking about, like authentic.
Yeah.
I'm a younger guy. I was a high school English teacher for a number of years. So it's like, you know what? I'm probably 10 years out from not being able to convincingly... Yeah.
That
talk like a
sail.
Teenager,
better,
exactly. Better yeah, no, I'm already becoming an old man. So that was my next book's going to be a bigger publisher. It's going to be Harper Teen. It's called Clown in the Cornfield. Thank you. So yeah,
Clown in a Cornfield.
It's called Clown in the Cornfield. Yeah.
Okay.
And tell us who blurbed your book?
Oh, just this. Just
he
last
just got
week,
good news. That's
I got.
Right.
I got good news that
cool.
Clive Barker. Actually, actually blurbed it, and I was emailing with the publisher this morning. I was like, "Can I tell?
What did
can
he
I
say?
Tell someone?
What did he say? Oh, can you paraphrase it?
I can. I can't paraphrase because it's a very Clive Barker.
Like he
thing.
Doesn't have it right in his.
I have it right.
But
in
the
my
funny
pocket.
Thing about that
it's
is
a
you
screen
can't
grab.
No, it is.
You can't underestimate that, because I'll never forget how I and probably most of us found out about Clive Barker was from the quote by Stephen King, and that made
everything.
A huge impression on me when I was young, because, you know, I'd seen Nightbreed first probably, but
I think it's like I've seen The Future of Terror and it's Clive Barker.
And that I will remember that quote forever.
It's imprinted in all of us.
Yeah.
From that era.
Yeah.
It's like,
I love Barker's work too, though. I think, I mean, even though, yeah, it's hard. I think ultimately it's like somewhere in my soul, maybe I'm more Barker than I am King, even though I love King.
I am.
I think the darkness of and the unknown is so.
It was weirder. It was weirder and definitely more, not imaginative, because that's a slight to King, but.
Well, it is fantasy.
It's otherworldly. I just did a whole podcast on kind of the mythos and theory behind Hellraiser and kind of what makes it Hellraiser, but it's what makes all Clive stuff the same, is that it has this otherworldly quality where there are no rules and there are other worlds and everything's really permeable. And at the same time, whereas King definitely plays with the idea of morality, every single person in Barker's stories have morality issues where you can't tell what's good or bad, and even the bad people are good, but the good ones are also being punished and they're not that good. It's very, very murky.
Like Harry D'Amore is not that.
Yeah.
He's not like a good, nice guy.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, I don't think that it comes out in, speaking of adaptations, like, because in prep for that, I read Hellbound Heart and then went back and rewatched Hellraiser. And it lost a little bit of kind of what I'll call the Barker of it, because when you read Hellbound Heart, it's a love story. Mm-hmm. Like, even the ending they changed for the movie, because in the ending, Kirsty is not his daughter, it's his lover. And she goes into hell at the end of the book to try to get him back. And so, like, it's just this crazy, crazy love story.
I still think it's a love story.
It has its moments.
I think
moments.
It's beautiful what she does.
I mean, Julia. I mean, if you think about it, Julia, that's the morality issues, because Julia is making this like crazy sacrifice in the name of love. But yet we walk away going, oh, she's the villain, but it's all in this name of love.
I guess the problem is, Frank doesn't really love her. Frank's just in it for the eroticism of it all. Yeah, he doesn't love anyone, but he's still one of the best characters. Mm-hmm. I find that truly frightening, him just in the shadows, sitting there, crouching, waiting for men to come. It's just a freaky.
And then she dies, and he doesn't really care.
Yeah, no, he's just kind of like, yeah, you're disposable.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to read this quote.
Okay.
You might as well, because
I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of it. I mean, I know.
It's not going to happen every day, so you should enjoy
it. It was just really cool. It says, Adam Caesar knows his horror. He conjures it effortlessly and leaves us alone in the midst of his nightmares. We may have encountered haunted cornfields, demented clowns, and bone-shredding chainsaws before, but never brought so effortlessly together in one sentence. Don't mistake this for a light read. It's a dark book from an author who knows how to make us afraid, which I was like,
that's pretty great.
Which I like cried for a good long time after.
Aww. Do you know how you got on somebody like that's radar in the first place?
I think they sent they were like, you know what? Screw it. We'll send a galley and see what happens. And
It shows you have to put yourself out there.
They did it. So I was like, thank you so much.
So Matt, where's your big quote?
Come on.
What the hell, let's get
Rob G can do it.
Well, Rob G did actually.
See, there you go.
Yeah. No, Rob was very kind enough to mention one of my first books on this podcast. I think it was actually Killer POV, but
I heard about Under the Blade on one of these.
That's episodes. What it was. Yeah.
I'll give you a quote on your next aquatic horror one. Give me another frilled shark, and I'm so there.
Okay. I remember these things. So.
Okay. I'm
but,
in.
Rob was very cool and definitely helped me move some books early on. So that was, thank you, Rob. I wish you were here.
What is that world like now? Because obviously, you know, I see a lot of people, like you were talking about, building an audience, having to put out more, like you know, Stephen King, you know, and people like that can put out a book whenever they want and they're going to live comfortably. Right. But you guys, obviously, if you're trying to do it as whether it's full time or balanced, I mean, even having Paul Tremblay on where he's like still working.
He's a math teacher.
He's a math teacher.
I hung out with him yesterday. He's still a math teacher.
Yeah, we just missed Paul.
Yeah, he was.
Always Southern Virginia.
I taped a different podcast with him on Monday and he was here for a quick signing. And I was like, are you starting school? He's like, I got a couple of weeks left, like talking about the day job. So.
So, what is that balance and what is that like, how, what is your process in a sense?
It's so different now, especially when you talk to people who've been doing it a little bit longer than we have. And we've been doing it for like 10 years.
Yeah, it's been a while.
But yeah, and it feels like 90. But it's like the idea of like, you have to be your own advocate and you have to be like half used car salesman, half like literary.
That's
person,
accurate.
You know what I mean? I don't mind doing it. And I know a lot of authors that don't feel as comfortable being a huckster and kind of leaning in and selling yourself, which is, I understand, it's like awkward sometimes. It's just like, I will, if someone tells me they liked my book, I will like immediately be like, could you please leave a review? which is a real shame. It's a shame that we're like, Amazon looms so large in our lives, and
they do, and so it's awful to have to be like, could you leave two sentences? But it's such an important part.
It
of
is
visibility and, wise. It's,
yeah. The algorithm. It's
the dreaded algorithm. The mysterious Amazon algorithm is like, it doesn't know that you have written a book that people like unless people tell Amazon, hey, here's a review. And the more people do that, the more our visibility like rises. So yeah, it's awful to have to do that. But
that's not just in the book world.
No.
Because I mean,
no.
Like when
podcasts, it's everything.
So it is, when Creatures came out last year, it hit VOD.
Which you very much enjoyed.
Thank you so much. But it hit VOD. And so immediately I'm like, refresh, waiting for any reviews to go up. And for 48 hours straight, the only review was like, this doesn't fucking have any blood in it. And I was like, Okay, it doesn't have much. I agree. It's got a little bit, but not much. That is true. Thank you, sir. And but that's the only one. And it reached a point where we were like emailing friends being like, can you guys just say something, just anything, so that it doesn't have any fucking blood in it. It's not at the top of the movie.
I know.
So,
when it's sitting up there, you just, all you think about is all the people that are like looking at your movie and going, I'll watch something else.
Like, well, you just feel so vulnerable. But it doesn't have any fucking blood in it. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one recently on Amazon that was literally like...
You read your reviews, Matt Serafini?
I do. I read them all. I read every single one.
I had to quit after a while because I would live in them. I would have like three okay, couple really positive, and then one negative, and that one I would live
That's
in
That's the one
for
that
days.
You focus
yeah,
on?
No,
you,
I wouldn't think about
anything
else.
You don't think about the positives.
Yeah, I'd just be like, well, it didn't matter how many good or mediocre or, hey, this was cool, this wasn't the best, but this part was cool, I'd get.
Yeah.
If there was one person that was like, this is garbage, I would live in that for days. Yeah. So I had to quit.
It's a bummer.
I think I think you get used to it a little bit because I think it's the quality of the reviews, because like if they're like really constructive and useful, then you try and learn something from it. But when it, like the one I just got was like literally a guy that was like, I read two pages and I hated it. And it was just like, well, sir, all due respect, I don't care what you have
the
to say.
The third page was killer.
Yeah, I was like, really? Like, was that third page is where it starts to cook, baby. Come on. Yeah. So, yeah.
But how do you start? I mean, because that first one, obviously, it's going to be hard to build an audience because you need somebody to buy the book. Or did you guys start with like online books, like Kindles? Like, I know a lot of writers start with something that's accessible, but not necessarily in print.
Right.
How'd you guys launch?
We both started in the smaller press. Like, I started small, medium-sized press with a company that's not around anymore, Samhain Publishing, but they were,
them. Yeah, they used to buy ads from us on Fanger. They were always nice to deal with.
They were a cool company because what they were trying to do is they were a romance publisher, and they'd had a lot of success with like ebooks and paperbacks, and they were like, you know what, we should expand. So they got this this great editor, Don Dioria, who did who was Leisure and Dorchester. He was the if you read a hard paperback in the 90s, he probably put it out, like Ed Lee and Richard Layman, all that stuff, Jack Ketchum, like it had a real pedigree. So I signed with them. So that my first book was Video Night, came out with them. But the way that this business just works is it's like you can't depend on a publisher. It's a little bit not like it was 20
years
ago.
At that level, they're not going to market you, really. They're not going
to
do much. So you have to be your own advocate.
Which is nice because, I was so grateful to have that book out with them. But, eventually they weren't around anymore. I put the book out myself, and it sells better now than it did, 7 years ago, which is a testament to that idea of like word of mouth and you're still finding new readers. You're still trying to find new readers. So it's just that like kind of, oops, there goes another rubber tree plant, kind of like, keep putting books out, keep pushing the old back catalog, and hopefully you get some traction. I'm very lucky to have people, and now with audiobooks, especially if people are listening to podcasts, they're probably like got an Audible subscription. And that's been a new thing for me where I've been.
Right.
And you've
breathed a new life.
Our back catalogs have been resuscitated in some ways by good audiobook productions. So
that's great. Yeah.
I've never listened to an audiobook yet. Because I always hear Ryan talk about it, but my brain spins at the idea, like in the sense I get the why because of the way people travel and move through space now. But it's so different because when I read a book, I'm the eye. And then my mind is having to put the pictures together as I read it. And so I'm not really sure it's like having a bedtime story read for you, which you do get some of that. Yeah.
No, I mean,
but
like,
it can't be the same experience. Your brain is definitely interacting differently.
I don't
know. Not necessarily bad, but.
No, it still functions the same though, because you're still looking at the page versus.
But somebody else's word is telling, somebody else's voice is telling you the story.
It's somehow, it still works the same for me because like I read on the subway, but like, every year I drive to Phoenix for Phoenix Comic Con, I'll usually buy an audiobook. Like 2 years ago, I listened to Hex, and I'll listen to it the whole way there and back. And you still envision it the same way. Like, and it's happening with your eyes open while you're driving or wherever you're going, but it still works.
It takes a little getting used to, I think. Because I wasn't, until I got an Audible subscription, it was like, a couple years ago. But now I'm just like, I'm like, my reading productivity is now when I'm walking the dog, you can hold the paperback while you're walking the dog, but it's probably not great.
Yeah.
I think sometimes though, like to your point, a narrator can really make or break it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That makes sense.
No, some people's voices will bother me. And mm-hmm. then sometimes, luckily, Audible does have this function where you can speed it up or slow it down.
Yep.
Because I tend to move at a very fast pace to begin with. So I get frustrated with people who have very long drawls.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I've had to bump it up like 1.5 before.
And sometimes the way, I don't know, it's weird, like men narrators do, sometimes they do really bad women voices.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes women narrators do really bad men voices.
Okay.
So it's like sometimes it's like, but I tend to listen to them when I've already read the book. Like I'll go, like that's how I'll kind of like reread a book. Mm. Like I'm like right now I'm going back through like all the Bret Easton Ellis books.
Oh,
kind of like just
does
listen.
He read them?
No, he reads his recent like his
the
nonfiction
White or whatever,
which is really good. And he does that one, mm. but no, the other ones
the Dawson. Other one.
Yeah, but no, it's so like I don't know.
But his suit that like see if it was American Psycho, that would make sense to me because it's about you're being narrated to in the book.
It's
that'd actually be a great
yeah.
one. Yeah, that'd
yeah.
be a great.
And
one.
That is
I
a good.
To that
who,
one.
Did
I,
that,
I,
who that was Pablo Schreiber,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a
and he
that's
does
a great performance.
Yeah, and he's really funny.
Have either of you done the reading?
No,
okay. I
would. Do they hire people like? Like voice
yeah.
artists
yeah.
for that.
Yeah, we got pros to.
Yeah, yeah, we got
like no yeah. one wants to listen to me for.
No.
I can hardly read our ads at the top. Usually, I like we all make mistakes yeah. and have to retake, and it's like one paragraph. So.
I would never do that to my readers.
Yeah, yeah.
I value them too much. Listen to this voice for 18 hours.
What's? Oh, sorry. You.
I was just going to ask, how long have you wanted to be writers?
Actually, I was going to ask the exact. Well, about books, I was going to ask the exact question.
Yeah,
I'm
like,
curious.
Were you the type of students who were constantly writing while you were in school, doing short stories, or did this emerge later? Had you always been interested?
You know, and Elric, you had asked at the beginning, like, where did it begin? And I think, yeah, the video store. And also my mom was always like kind of ignorantly buying me like because she would – my dad was the guy that would take me to the video store. My mom would take me to the bookstore. My dad would let me rent whatever the hell I wanted. So my dad would be like, you know, I'm 10 years old. And he would be like, we can rent Halloween. And that's a true story. And we'd bring it home. And my mother would be like, what the hell are you letting them watch this for? You know, and but then she'd take me to the bookstore and let me read it. Like yeah. she would buy, so it was like, mom, you're actually doing the more damage, yeah. but you don't know. but yeah. And so like my mom would really like a lot of the books that I'm going to talk about, like were stuff that like I were kind of with me from a very young age and, mm-hmm. and kind of just, I always wanted to do that. And in like fourth grade, when we would do like fiction writing in school, I would write like little Friday the 13th stories where mm-hmm. like Jason, we'd go on a field trip and Jason would kill my classmates. Mm-hmm. And like, thank God my teachers
weren't. That'll get you arrested
now.
Right.
Yeah.
And they literally at the time were like, oh, Matthew, this is so funny. the world has changed. You know, the world has moved on.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's it's always kind of been a part of me. And
but,
I've always
but to
kind
do
of
a book, like, see, most like if you're a horror kid watching a lot of VHS, maybe you write some short stories, but at some point probably you get a film bug and you may write a script, which is a very different beast.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea, the actual, to me, I'm always so impressed by anyone who writes a novel, even a bad mm-hmm. novel. It, to me, it's just, there's something about that achievement, which is really impressive. Well, where did you know, I want to write a book, not a screenplay, not a movie.
Well, how long was your first book? Like, how long did it take you to write your first book?
Not very, I don't know. I just kind of chipped away. I was doing, I did a couple short stories and stuff and then I just, I don't know. I just, like a year maybe. It's
yeah.
longer than all the other ones. But I think like similar to Matt where I was read to as a child. Mm-hmm. My dad, my mom would read me stuff and they'd read me stuff where it was like,
yeah.
you know, like stuff I couldn't even understand where yeah. I knew I liked spooky stuff. I knew I liked horror from pre-reading mm-hmm. times. And it would be like, well, I my dad was had this beautiful cover, beautiful collection of King hardcovers with the original dust jackets on them. And he would like read me some of this stuff. And I would, and then I was like, you know, I think it was like, I don't know, third or fourth grade. I was like, we had to do a biography. So they had this little children's readers biography in the school library about Stephen King. So I was like, let me do about Stephen King. And we cut up all the, it was like, was so young that we weren't doing like a book report. We were doing a mobile. Hmm. So I made a Stephen King mobile, but
oh, cool.
I wish I didn't because I cut all the dust jackets off the things
he
uses. It was pre, you know, printers. We didn't have a printer in the house. So we'd
that's cool that he let you cut those jackets.
Yeah.
That tells you something there.
But I think it's that idea that like, okay, well, King and Barker, they, you know, especially Barker, like, you know, and King directed films. They were multimedia, like Barker with the comics. And it's the idea that like, I never thought of it as like in a one to one of like, this is movies, this is books. I kind of was like, oh, it all feeds in together because I just like it all. I like horror. So I think it was kind of the natural progression. Mm-hmm. I think it took me till later. Like I took like creative writing classes in high school and stuff like that and did like little clubs, but I never even thought of it as like any kind of like life path until like college, where I was like, oh, maybe I should just mess around and write a novel. And that's what I did. What about you?
No, that's pretty much the same thing. Yeah. So it took me like 3 years to write my first book.
And is it saying you kind of get addicted to the feeling of completing that world, that effort, or is it something? It might be a high. I don't understand. I guess is what I'm getting.
Oh, it feels so good to have written. Like it feels really, really good. And it's also like it's one part like you want to feel good that you've written something, and it's the other part of like the crushing. Like I didn't. I'm a piece of shit. I didn't write today. It's really that. Where it's like I'm a neurotic person, and like if I get in a habit of like I should do this every day or I should do a little bit of this, I feel terrible.
You train yourself. It becomes like I have to do that instead of binging this show that sounds more fun, but I have to torture myself and spend 3 hours writing today.
Do you have a pattern with your writing? Like you always write first thing in the morning or right after lunch or right before bedtime, or like what is your pattern and do you have to keep that to maintain creativity?
I try not to. I do like just get a head of steam up, or if I start writing earlier, I just go faster. And then eventually it's time to stop or I'm like exhausted. Like
my kids keep me on a, like I can't predict it. So it's like whenever they're cooperating and go to bed, then it's like, okay.
Oh, the 8 to p.m. to 10 p.m. work. That's when I do everything.
The 8 to 10 p.m. is the magic hour. Yes.
That is the only time I get shit done. Yep.
Did you guys see that documentary on Larry Cohen?
Oh yeah, the King Cohen.
I love the part where he talks about writing, how he was just, a writer, and then at a certain point he was just like, you know what, I got kids and maybe I'll just start doing this at night, and just would, start at 10 p.m. or whatever and go till 4 in the morning, and it just worked. It was just a really interesting way. I mean, he just seems like such, in terms of film writing, he seems like one of the purest writers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, yeah. An idea machine.
Idea, like literally like some of the best concepts.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Ever.
And when you see that, when you see his home office in that documentary, it's like, look at all this. Like he left so many scripts. Like,
oh yeah,
and he was trying to get them done. To like, it was just incredible. It's insane to me. Yeah.
We read one at Jump Cut a couple of years ago, Movie House that had never been made and was dated when we read it. And even though that we were listening to it, going, "Oh, this is really dated," it was so good. It was really meta.
Well, in the documentary where it shows him watching that, there's something in the way he looks that, I mean, it's also constructed in the documentary, but it really was touching me beyond the Jump Cut connection. It was touching to see this guy. Well, it's touching in the sense that, hey, we kind of helped let him see his work, and he's got these actors, and I could just tell how much he was enjoying it. Mm-hmm. It's really pleasurable to see someone who enjoys the work. It's not just work to do work, and it's not to get ahead. Right. He needs to do it. I think writers maybe have the most purest experience of that. Film directing is such a ridiculous endeavor and so frustrating, because it's about, even if you are a writer as well, you're still having to wait long, long, long periods between things.
You're managing a lot of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're just different. I think they're probably different satisfactions. But do you remember the first time you guys saw a movie you loved and realized it was based on other material and then kind of charted back to that material? And if it's one of your picks, you can say, I defer to later in the program.
I defer to later.
Okay, we'll take that.
I can't even – no. It's. Yeah. I guess it's just that idea of like, oh, I always – maybe it was because of my dad's King Hardback.
It's probably
because I kind of just always like – yeah, I always was just like, oh, that's how this goes.
Yeah,
like, it's that's a good question. I had never even thought of it.
Neither had I. I can't answer it. Well, let's jump into our adaptations and see what comes from that. Because
cool.
Now, were these supposed to be your favorites or lesser known ones?
It's kind of a little weird.
Mine's a hodgepodge.
Okay, because I did lesser known ones, but I think they're all good, or I wouldn't have put them on here. But they're all like lesser known ones.
I have way more than five things I think are interesting, and interesting in the fact that they are adaptations in some sense.
Yeah, mine make there's no thematic sense here. It's just some of them are interesting, some of them I really like.
I picked five Stephen King ones, so I guess we've all got our wires cut now. But I will admit to being the ignoramus on the show that who picked all five. Yeah, and I haven't read any of the five books of these movies, but like all these movies, and now a couple of them, I'm very interested to go find the books because a couple of them I knew about, but the books are so different. I mean, Paperbacks from Hell obviously gets you very intrigued especially the ones that did become films. Yep. You want to kind of go backwards. And a friend of ours, Jim Koons, they were working on the, and Stephen Scarlett have been working on the documentary
novelizations. Thank you.
They've been working on that for the last couple of years.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing it for they've got interviews amazing. With everyone.
Jim has an amazing collection.
And by talking about it right now, he will go, oh, good, this is a good kick in the ass to keep going.
Yeah, no, Jim, we want that.
Yeah, Jim, hi, Jim, I want that really badly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and to do it, they had to buy, I mean, I think they bought like every one of them. And they have a library of them, including the one I've always wanted to see, the Pit one, the Teddy.
It was a Teddy.
Book, and it's very different. That's why I want to read it, because it's like
the teddy bear is the central character.
It sounds really creepy and weird. Why don't you guys jump in first, and we talk about movies all the time here, so let's let you guys lead off the.
I'm going to start with a movie I'm going to start with Philip Morrow's The Beast Within.
Oh, okay. Nice.
All right. So you guys has everybody seen?
We've had Philly on the show before.
I know. He's
killer POV days. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love
Philly. One of the most cultured humans I've ever met.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine.
This guy is amazing because he is, like you say, incredibly cultured. Yeah. He makes like these really thoughtful like Holocaust documentaries and stuff. And then
he lived with Eric Clapton, was his roommate.
And then he makes like bladder effect like beast rape movies.
Howling too.
So it's like what? Yeah. So he's like the most fascinating guy. But so this movie is it's okay. Like I like a lot of his stuff. This is not my favorite Philip Morrow movie.
Is your favorite on the list?
But it's based on an Edward Levy novel. It's got the same name, but it's different. And so they kind of have this, they follow sort of the same structure, except the novel has like, there's like an act one that the movie doesn't tackle. And basically, the novel is more psychological. So there's no like actual transformation into bladder effects or anything like that. And it's basically, this really interesting, like kind of prequel to the events that happened in the movie where basically it's set in like it's been a long time since I read it. It's like the '20s or the '30s. And it's like, this evangelical guy and his wife. And he's like this real like abusive husband, and she's very miserable. And then this Bible salesman comes by the house one day while he's not there, and sort of like seduces the wife, and they have this affair. And then surprise, surprise, the pastor, the preacher, whatever he is, I forget. He comes home and catches them. And he imprisons the guy in their house. Like he imprisons him in the basement, and he like keeps him there for years. And he basically like dehumanizes the guy like little by little, and and turns him into like this like feral creature. It just kind of like by stripping away all his humanity. And then, it's this really like depressing, awful story. It's like really well written. It's really like disturbing. And then the guy like ends up breaking loose and running rampant. And then he attacks this woman. And that's sort of where the movie begins.
Yeah.
The movie starts with that sort of attack sequence. And the really interesting thing about the movie is that it sort of about the book is that it explores kind of like, because this guy attacks this woman, and then the woman, you know, ends up giving birth to this boy, and then the boy has the same sort of like tendencies, but because it's all psychological and it's inherited, it's this really interesting exploration of kind of like how that behavior is learned. And again, it's all psychological, so it's you know, the people that really like the movie may be disappointed, but it's a really great book, and the movie is. The movie's okay.
Yeah, it's fascinating what is the part of the book that you – because usually it's just one thing that the person adapting it really loves and wants to make take in a different direction. Did you ever read one – I only learned about it because it was at the back of Rue Morgue. Mm-hmm. I guess they spotlight older books.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was Let's Play at the Atom.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was hard to find.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I paid 80 bucks for – or 60 bucks for a really shitty paperback.
Oh, you do? You have it?
I read it, and it's – the only reason I bring it up because you were talking about dehumanizing. It's very much like – it's like Last House on the Left mixed with a kid's film. And it's just these kids, you know, their babysitter's coming over, their parents are going to be away, and all the kids are basically in cahoots to, hey, let's all get get together, chain her up, and abuse her. It's not sexual initially because the kids are below that age, but right. one of them isn't. One of them is a bit older, and then you just start, it's kind of Lord of the Flies. But it's a really disturbing book. Could be a good movie if done, if, you know, you'd have to.
Sounds like Girl Next Door.
It definitely has a catch-em-ass feel. The writing doesn't at all, but the scenario does. But it was a nice surprise, and it's fun to stumble upon books like that.
It is. Did you like the book though? Like, is it?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's good. Like, it was hard.
Yeah.
Especially when it does take that turn.
Yeah.
Up until then, it's just really entertaining. You're trying to figure out how they're going to get away, what's going to happen by the end. Mm-hmm. But it's one that I could instantly see, because sometimes, you know, coming maybe more from the filmmaking perspective, I'm almost always reading, thinking like, I wonder what this would be like on a screen. Books, mm-hmm. and so.
Right. Well, that's the thing about The Beast was, if I was reading The Beast Within with an eye towards making it a movie. The movie was written by Tom Holland too,
so
I'd love to actually talk to him about it. But it's like the beginning of it is the best stuff, and that's what I would have thought would have made the more interesting movie. And that's the stuff that they were just like, nope, cut that completely.
Yeah, that's interesting. So. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, cool.
Nice.
All right. this next book movie pairing, I hadn't really heard of. It's a Ray Russell book. It's called Incubus, and I was given it to by our mutual friend Mark Siebert at a convention. He just like randomly handed it to me, and I don't normally just give everything its immediate read, but I was like, you know what, I'll start this. And Ray Russell did Sardonicus and The Case Against Satan is that one of his, but it's like he's known for kind of more classic horror, and this is a book that's. I think it was a hit when it came out. I think it was like a later 70s.
Late
70s.
The cashing, it was the Satan craze.
It was the Satan craze. Yeah. But it was a, like, it's a book about, it's almost like a procedural where you have these attacks are happening, and they are sexual in nature, and they're like leaving these women dead. And it was like really explicit. And I was like, why the hell did Mark give me this? Kind of like, and it just kind of was like, it's one of those books where it's I'm not entirely sure I liked it because I thought it was kind of wrongheaded and it's super dated. And then I didn't know there was a film adaptation. And then, I don't know, maybe like a month or 2 months after I finished reading it, Vinegar Syndrome was like announced their titles and they were like, oh, we're doing Incubus. I was like, I didn't even know this was a movie.
Wow.
So it was a 1982 movie, John Hoff.
Or Hogue, I don't know. H-O-U-G-H. Yeah.
If only I had John Cassavetes as a doctor.
Yes.
But John Cassavetes is in it, and he's trying to – and, you know, before the movie even came from the mail from Vinegar Syndrome, I was like, how the hell do you do this story, this, like, really grody, wrongheaded story? And
well, it's like the – the first half's like The Entity.
It is.
In terms of the really explicit attacks.
And and it's toned down from the book. Yeah. So, like, the movie kind of gets it right. This is why I put this on my list, not – 100% because it's lesser known, because I think you guys even talked about it when you watched it.
It's one of my highest picks on my list. I love the movie as much as you can say I love a movie that's like gross and sexual in that way, but it was definitely one of those first movies I saw. I definitely saw it on VHS, and it was like a shower movie where you're like, oh, I feel like I need a shower, because it is kind of dirty and sleazy.
Incubus, right?
The Incubus, it's the small town, like a kind of, is it a Massachusetts kind of town?
Yeah, it's a Massachusetts. I think they're doubling Southern California for Massachusetts, but they changed it to a Massachusetts town in the movie, and I really like the movie.
I came at it through Cassavetes. I was like, I've seen everything Cassavetes. Oh, what's this movie? And then I was like, holy shit, what?
When that incubus breaks down that door, it's like, geez, this movie's escalating. And
demon effects are really cool once it goes
awesome.
There.
Yeah, they're really creepy and effective, and they're that skinny, like, it's really cool looking. And not to spoil it, but if you haven't seen the movie, but the movie changes the book's ending, and it gives it that early, late 70s, early 80s, you know, downbeat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much better ending than the ending of the book. It was a movie that I was like, well, now I have to see this because I read this book that I wasn't really.
What's the statute really of limitations? Spoilers. With. Can you?
I'm not gonna talk about the end of it, but I would highly recommend people check out.
Is it to the book's ending to the film? Same.
The ending is completely different. The book, the movie itself is actually a fairly faithful adaptation, but it just changes just enough, and it's as grody as the movie is, which is pretty grody. Like it's less grody than the book, and in a way that makes it like, okay, this is I can meet this movie halfway, and Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I have a soft spot for movies that like are so mixed in terms of like, is it a slasher? Nope. Now it's a supernatural. Like, because that movie seems that like just a straight slasher.
Yeah. Yep.
Then it becomes a weird supernatural thing. Then it becomes a procedural. And when it's done right, I tend to love that, even if the film seems confused. And the director's a good director, so he's, you know, it pulls it together. So that would have been my pick, one of my picks too. So we'll go around because I love that one.
You sold me on Incubus the movie. I'll start there.
And and you're lucky because I had never seen a good copy. I just got the Vinegar Syndrome. Myself haven't seen it yet, but like if your first time is seeing a good version of this,
it's really great. It's nice. And not to write off Ray Russell, Sardonicus is a great novella. It's like it's like one of like the best kind of gothic horror.
Was that adapted to Sardonicus?
Sardonicus is that the William Castle movie?
Yes, it's kind of the smiling man. There's an adaptation of it, and it's Castle's is pretty accurate to the novella, but
end you get to decide the ending, which you never get to do. Yeah. But suppose
they were gonna play that reel anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the forgive or punish.
Yeah, forgive
ending.
Or punish. Yeah, yeah. But there was only ever one ending, and they were taking votes, and turn.
No, that was my turn.
Oh, okay.
Anytime you have a double, we will keep it. Right.
Then I'm gonna go. The movie is from 2001 called The Hole. The book is from the early 90s called After the Hole. And I read After the Hole when I was in high school, and it destroyed me. Like, I remember thinking about it for days afterwards. It's set in a British boarding school, and a group of kids find this old war bunker nearby the school in the woods. And they say, okay, two guys and two girls, we're going to sneak out there this weekend and we're going to have a party in this bunker. And they get into the bunker.
Oh, you're saying this. And I just remembered the movie. Yeah.
Close the door and they're trapped and they can't get back out and they're stuck in there and they have no food and limited access to water. There's like some gross ghetto toilets that have been there since like the dawn of time when they built the bunker. And everything's disgusting and they don't know what to do and they can't get back out. And it really breaks down into Lord of the Flies with four kids in a bomb shelter and everything that happens. And so it's very psychological and it volleys back and forth between reality and they all start kind of, one in particular starts kind of having these, I'll call them like almost delusions, hallucinations, where she's picturing it one way, but then sometimes we'll get glimpses that it's probably not. And they did more of that in the movie than they did in the book. They make it a little bit murkier in the movie.
Is Thora Birch in it?
Thora Birch and Keira Knightley. Keira Knightley's in it too.
Okay. I literally had forgotten this movie. And you start talking as soon as you hit the girls in the bunker. I was like, I have seen that.
So the movie's from 2001. And I love it too. Like, I remember seeing it and being like, okay, they did a decent job. Movie did not get much reception. It fell off the face of the earth really quickly. Yep. Keira Knightley is amazing in it. She's plays an anorexic in it who is stuck down there with them. And everything kind of comes to life on that. And it's just, I really enjoyed it. So that's definitely one of my deeper cuts. But if you have not seen 2001 The Hole yet, it's a really fun movie and fun read.
It's one of those movies that I think like that was back when like stuff would just kind of quietly come out on
DVD.
It was like either Artisan or something like that. I remember being like that kind of thrill of like, oh, well, this looks legit. And, you know, it's just a new release movie and just being delighted when it turned out to be The Hole.
It's big budget. Yeah. I mean, Thora Birch was more well known at the time than I think Keira Knightley was. She's probably 16 in the movie. You can still immediately see that it's her as soon as it starts.
That's awesome.
Not the Joe Dante film, The Hole.
I
liked it too.
My kids like it. Yeah. If you haven't, like,
it showed in 3D not long ago.
It's Evil Clowns.
It is Evil Clowns.
Clowns come out of the hole.
We went to a restaurant and it was like a 50s diner. And I guess there's a clown, like, you know, just a bust of a clown. He literally had to change seats because he couldn't handle. So he will not be reading your book.
Oh, no.
In the cornfield.
When we were going
one off the list.
So. Yeah.
You and I spent like the last week at the movies. On Saturday, we took our collective broods and we went to see Dora the Explorer.
Oh.
Which was a fucking blast.
It was pretty good.
Fun. But I remember as we're walking past this giant it standee, Elric turns around and goes, No one mention the clown.
Everyone keep walking. Don't look to the right. Don't look to the right. Because that is like, I look at that and when I realize, oh, if you were a kid and you're scared, the fact that that's even out in public, you realize, no, that probably would give you nightmares.
It's traumatizing.
Because it's, yeah, that's a really disturbing face. Clown. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he can't even look at like the Goosebump type, slappy type characters. They're the ones that creep him out more, I think. It's funny because you wonder, where did that start? How did you know that's inherently creepy? I didn't show him anything.
Well, they definitely do facial expressions because Marnie is not in any way bothered by clowns, but she'll still look at it and go, oh, he's evil. Mm-hmm. So like it's all
yeah they can read faces
there's something inherent just get it. My even my four-year-old is he knows Pennywise and it's not from me, which I promise.
Sure. No, it's interesting. Okay, so what's your next one?
I'm gonna go with Nightwing.
I've got the novella. Like it was a movie, but maybe I've got the movie adaptation of it.
Well, that's what I actually just read the book. I was given a copy by Mark Sieber book, and I thought it was a novelization, but it's not. It's Martin Cruz Smith, and I think there's like a there's a reprint of it with the movie cover or whatever, and that's what I have.
That might be what I does it have any pictures in it?
I think it does. Yeah,
some photos in the middle. Yeah,
but. So I had seen the movie years ago, and I actually just watched it before I flew out here. Have you seen the movie?
I don't think I have, because when I was looking through this book, I don't know how it came into my possession. And I was like, I don't feel like I've ever seen this.
Yeah,
it's with bats, right?
It's with bats. Well, yeah, vampire bats on an Indian reservation.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's weird because it's Arthur Hiller directed the movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so it's weird. Well, it's weird if you're looking at his filmography coming up from Love Story on. It's less. I guess it's less weird if you're like looking at the back end of his filmography.
Like anyone, yeah.
And you're like, oh, Carpool.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
But so the book, I think Martin Cruz Smith also wrote the screenplay. He might have been rewritten, I don't know, but they're similar. And it's just it's one of those movies. It was like in the book was after Jaws, and so like it was written very much in that post Jaws craze where everything was like
could have been post Orca. You don't know.
It could have been post Orca.
So why you got to go with Jaws?
I don't know. That's true.
Maybe Orca should be on this list too. Actually,
we're not going to rush judgment on. Yeah. So everything had to be sort of educational. Like it's like because like if you read the book, you're going to learn a lot about vampire bats. Yeah. You're also going to learn a lot about sort of like Native American tribes in America, and it's a really kind of interesting. There's a lot going on in the book, so it's like it's ostensibly it's about killer vampire bats, but it's also about sort of like tensions between like white people and like Native Americans on this reservation. There's also sort of these like warring factions of Native Americans where some of them are all about like, hey, there's oil on this land and we're fine. We're going to sell it. We don't care. And then there's others that are like, no, you can't. So it's this really, it like works way harder than it probably needs to be. It's a story about killer vampire bats. Yeah. And the movie
Wait, what? I had to go to the restroom. And then you said killer vampire bats as soon as I walked back in.
Nightwing. Yeah,
Nightwing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, what was the movie?
Nightwing.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I'm in. And it's got David Warner shows up in the movie. He's like the Richard Dreyfuss character. He's kind of the expert on vampire bats. And he's like the only guy who knows how to kill them. And, Nick Mancuso plays the Native American, which would never happen today because he's about as Italian as it gets. He's like the Native American sheriff who's sort of like caught up in this whole thing. The movie is if you like kind of slow burn 70s movies, it's kind of cool, but it's definitely slow. It definitely takes itself a little maybe too seriously at times. And the vampire bat attacks, they're okay.
It's hard to pull that off. I mean, even when I watch Suspiria now, like that's the one scene that I go, oh,
yeah.
And there's something charming about how fake it is now, like this weird artifice that makes, I wouldn't want it out of the movie,
right?
But it does take, it goes on for a long time and it's very fake.
It's funny that you say that because there's a scene in the movie where they kind of enclose themselves in like a mesh cage and they've electrocuted it and they're like they lure all the bats to them and they like converge on the cave and it's, they're freaking out and then you see like the bats and it's like,
my sister lives in Brisbane in Australia and anytime I visit there, it is mind-blowing that there are fucking tons of bats in the city. You'll be on a boat or sitting on the corner, and there's just bats in the sky, and you're like, this is crazy, but it's just normal.
Do you not have bats?
I've never lived somewhere where there's – I've never been anywhere where there's bats just hanging out everywhere.
Like a fuckload of bats.
This isn't like I saw a bat once. This is like, no, where you go out, you see bats, and I just had never seen that in the sky, and it was kind of cool. No, in New Zealand, I've never seen
bats. Virginia, we have – you'll see the bats every night.
Really?
Like, yeah,
really?
Around dusk time. Actually, this sounds so lame and backwoodsy, but when I was a kid, we used to pull them down. You can take a sock, like a tube sock, and you put a rock in it and tie it in a knot, and then you throw it up in the air, and the bats will follow it down. And so they always told us not to touch them because they could have rabies, but you can watch them like follow it down and then get confused and take back off.
And they don't do anything to
you? They don't do anything. They definitely don't. I mean, I'm a
little scared. Nightwing has trained you wrong.
Vampire bats don't even really do anything. Vampire bats, they make a tiny slit and then they actually lap the blood up with their tongue as it seeps out naturally.
It's like a coagulant.
Yeah, and it's an anticoagulant thing and it takes a long time to feed and it's also a numbing thing, I would assume. They mostly feed on boat, like cows, because what human is going to just sit there casually while they do this? So I think it's mostly like sleeping cattle that get hit.
Well, you need to see this movie because David Warner, if you listen to David Warner in the movie, it's like they are like the number one threat.
Oh, wow. They don't descend from the sky and rip your eyeballs out or anything like that.
Martin Cruz Smith.
That's what David Warner says.
Yeah, get out of here. Yeah,
so that's Nightwing. It's I don't know. I like the book. I like the movie.
I just see Becca Whittling. From your story, I just see you whittling and looking at bats at night. Like, I'm just waiting for the bourbon to distill or whatever you do.
We used to catch June bugs.
Okay.
I told you that one before, right?
I don't think so. Killer June bugs. No one's done that.
No, killer June bugs.
Wait, what's this?
When I was a kid, much like the bat story, you can do it with bees as well, but we did June bugs. You can take a Tupperware container full of ice and you run around and you catch the June bugs and you put them in the ice and it'll knock them out. And then you tie a really loose little thread around their neck and you've got a June bug on a string because it'll wake back up as soon as it's out of
the
ice.
What's going on in Virginia?
That's bleak.
I'm from the back area. And then you free it. I would never just leave it on a string.
Yeah. Wow. That is actually quite a great scene to be in something.
I'm
about
learning
childhood.
A lot like about
that.
Yeah. This is as educational as Nightwing.
Yeah.
It's going to be a race to see who puts the June bugs in a book.
You can also do it with Japanese beetles.
All right.
The more you know, folks.
Taking some notes.
Okay, well, I've got two here that definitely aren't lesser known because I guess I misunderstood the prompt or like I just ignored the prompt. And I was like, quick, think of movies.
Let me just interject here because you're the one who sent me the prompt and the exact wording was written by you. And the exact wording, as you have Clive Barker writing on your jacket, I have your writing in my phone, and your writing says underrated horror adaptations.
We went back and forth on that, and I just passed it along. We went back and forth on that, and I was tired. But okay,
I will screenshot it for the audience. But continue.
I want my hardcore horror cred to like still
right,
come
right.
across.
No, you can do whatever you want.
I want to do some stuff that all people right. probably have heard of. Legend of Hell House, 1973.
Oh, yeah.
Roddy McDowell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we just did a live show at Long Beach on our favorite ghost story, and that was and rewatching. I hadn't seen it for a while, but I rewatched it for that. And killer movie. It's such
also
a great
John
movie.
Hoff.
Yeah,
that's right. That's why it's yeah.
So I've got
look at you. You're an old tourist.
I got two by the same director, and then two by the same author.
Okay,
so,
cool.
But Legend of Hell House. I've seen it a while ago. I've seen it like either on VHS or DVD. I don't remember which, and I remember liking it. And then I'm from Philly, so there's Exhumed Films does. Yeah. They do their Horrorthon every Halloween. They do X Fest.
The 24-hour thing.
The 24-hour, and then X Fest is 12 hours. And then throughout the year, they'll do little like either double features or triple features. And one of the double features was Legend of Hell House, a 35mm print. But it watching it on the big screen really put me back in the – I think I'd seen the movie before I'd ever read the book, which it's based on Hell House by Richard Matheson. Mm-hmm. And I kind of – even though it had been like probably over a decade since I'd read the book, rewatching the movie, I was like, this is a damn good adaptation. And it's – I think it's – did Matheson write the script? I know he wrote a ton of scripts and a ton of his own adaptations. So it's – I think it's Matheson adapting Matheson, and it's the idea of like Hell House is a kind of more hardcore retelling of Shirley Jackson's Legend of Hill House. Mm-hmm. And it really is like a deliberate rewriting and a deliberate retelling. And it's kind of almost like a writing exercise for Matheson. You get the idea. And seeing this adaptation so kind of expertly done, even like the pseudoscience stuff, even like they're in a house and they're something terrible has happened, and they get the one survivor of this haunting, and he comes back and he's like, now this, there you have two different types of psychics that are coming to investigate, and this whole team, and they're, you know, at the end they're going to like turn on this machine that's going to like unhaunt the house, and it just all works. Like
Roddy McDowell's the survivor.
Yeah, exactly. He's a survivor, and I can't remember now I'm like mixing up the film, because in the book he's explicitly gay. Like they state explicitly
that
he's like, which is like it's very, again, it's a modern kind of retelling of Hill House. So mm-hmm. it has that kind of, I can't remember if it's late 60s.
I think it's heavily implied in the movie.
I think it's shown because the wife of the main psychologist guy who goes in, she gets possessed, goes down, takes off all her clothes, comes onto Roddy McDowell, and does nothing. So probably they're saying it like implicitly. You know.
Yeah, I do. It's just, even, you know, 73, like seeing this movie, it felt very modern. Like, so we're talking about stuff, my first pick was something that feels somewhat regressive and somewhat dated, even though I enjoy it. Like it was an adaptation that felt like it even got rid of some of the elements that may not age so well of in Hell House. It's just so expertly done.
It's a really disturbing film too.
Yeah,
like
it's scary. Yeah.
Yeah,
so, cause it could just be a classic haunted house thing like The Haunting, but it's not. It goes into this very disturbing territory, and there's weird stuff with cats and shadows, and there's sexual stuff, and and the reveal of who's behind it is really great. It's got some great twists.
And it's implied through like what this ghost does and who this ghost might have been, that this like Caligula-esque figure of this, you know,
it makes, I never tire of Roddy McDowell at the end. Like he's like emasculating the ghost.
Yeah.
You are shot. It's the greatest.
That's it. Yeah. I forgot the ghost battle.
Oh, it's the best.
It's really, and because we just did this episode recently, I probably Burnt Offerings probably would be on this list as an adept, but we already just talked about it. I'll do mine quicker because I'm not smart enough to have read them all. One that I just love and I will always beat the drum for on the show and have been for years is Pin, Plastic Nightmare. I think it's still underrated because it's still not available on DVD, or Blu-ray, which is ridiculous, criminal. I did an episode Projection Booth on it, and I read excerpts of the book. I think it's fairly faithful. I think there was one major difference, and it's escaping me now. But this is it was by Andrew. I want to make sure I at least plug all the authors of the books. This is Andrew Niederman. It was directed by Sander Stern. It's a film, you know, basically kind of what you'd say is another one of these kind of psycho lineage movies.
It's great.
And it's also great because it toys with, is this plastic medical doll actually a supernatural figure, or is it in this kid's mind? So the kid's doctor father has always like spoken with this dummy to tell his kids certain information, but he's a very cold father. So they're probably
the great Terry O'Quinn.
Terry O'Quinn, yeah. And I think the kids kind of bond to that. The boy certainly does to that dummy because of the lack of maybe caring from his actual father.
Right.
And so he grows up having conversations with it. And eventually there's a really creepy scene where the dad's trying to get rid of the doll and driving it. And it is just scary. And it's done so well. It's so well directed that you do question if it's supernatural for a good portion of the movie.
Yeah. You sit there for a while going, it's about to move, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a fucking thing is going to move right now.
And do you know who the voice of the pin is?
No.
It's Mike from Breaking Bad.
Oh my gosh.
No way, is it?
It's one of his first roles. It's one of those crazy things that you read and go, what? It's
wow. Like, yeah. I have the old Anchor Bay DVD. I've been hanging on to it for your life. Because as you said, it's
why isn't it out? It's a movie that I've heard about endlessly.
I'm sure.
It comes up on the Projection Booth episode, but it was years ago now. I've just totally forgotten.
But I'm sure that like Scream Factory has tried at some point to put Pin out. So
they're all Canadian.
Sure,
all those Canadian tech shelter money movies must be a little iffy, some of them. But this is not just a like, oh, it's pretty good. It's actually kind of a great movie.
It is. I
it's
agree
really
with you.
It's kind of classy, well directed. It's very psychological. And the main performance we were just talking about Vincenzo Natali. The lead actor in this is the guy who's been in every one of Vincenzo's movies.
Oh.
It's his good buddy. The guy he's in Scanners Two. He's
Peter.
His name's just forget. He's the lead in Cube. He's been in small roles all the way through.
Who was the lead in Cube?
Is it Peter Cube. David or did I make
no no
that
no?
Up
there was title? No lead in Cube.
Oh well, he's I think one of the main guys who talks up.
Oh wait, wait, one okay. Who no, kind of hate Martin the, Hewitt, right?
Yeah,
Martin
Hewitt. David Hewitt. Oh maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Even, you're yeah. totally right with the
Hewitt,
last name.
Somebody Hewitt.
It's Hewitt. That's completely right. And it's just a really good performance. And I think Vincenzo might have even seen him in this to cast him in other things.
I feel bad. I haven't read the book, but yeah.
No, I haven't either. And so
I love that movie.
My job today will be to send people to the book. That one I have heard is a good book, though. Some of the ones I'm picking maybe are picture books.
But it's a hard to find book, right?
I don't know. I really, it showed how much homework I did. Yeah. I picked movies I liked because I wanted to push the movies.
Well, I'll go with Pontypool, and Pontypool changes everything.
I did not know that Pontypool was a book.
Really?
I thought it was this really original movie that came out of, and I did not know it was a book.
The book's incredible.
The book is great.
I read the book came out at like mid-90s, and I read that right when I first started working at Fangoria, so it'd be like 2002. And then I think the movie was 2008. And yeah, the movie, it's, I love the movie, and it's absolutely incredible. Too. But the book was so well, it handled the vocalizations much better. Kind of like the way that they would attach words to other words and how the disease spread. That got weird and murky in the movie where they're just like, okay, well, it's probably spread through a single word. Like when I say the word this to you, that has passed the virus onto you. And it's not as clear. And the characters don't seem to embody it as much as they do in the book, where they literally start creating a whole new language.
The book is a trip because of that, because it's like there's parts of it where it's like, what is this?
Yeah. like the characters literally have to start speaking a different language to be able to communicate with each other because it's attached through connotations that we make with words. So instead of saying cat, I have to say aardvark, or that would even be too close. Like it can't even be in the same group. But this sounds complicated, but the book makes it really clear.
But the book movies, holds your hand through it. And I agree. The movie takes some leaps where you're like, I don't know how they got there.
That movie opens like a freight train.
Oh my God. That opening's great.
Steve McCaddy being like, well, I have a microphone in front of me, like the Mrs. French's cat. Is
He's so good.
Mazzy,
good. That felt like one of the most wildly original movies I had seen in a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kind of similar feeling to when I first saw Killers, but I was just, where you're just like, oh, where did this come from? I know the director is Bruce McDonald, who had been making a lot of cult cinema in Canada for a long time, but that's why I didn't know it was a book. I just thought it was this original.
Canadian author as well, right?
Yeah, Tony Burgess. Who I believe there are other Pontypool books. I'm going to look this up now. Oh. But for some reason, I thought that this was like, that it may have had inclusions.
That's the problem with this industry. I want a Pontypool 2 more than I want Zombieland 2. You know what I mean? Like, I want to see where that world goes.
Oh my gosh, yeah. No, I want because it is so contained within the radio studio. And then at the end, we either know that they leave the studio or they have that weird trippy moment where they're like dressed up like all fancy at a cafe and you're like, are they in hell? I don't know what's going on. But I wanted to see what the remainder of the world looked like. Like, how do they adapt to it? Because it feels like suddenly they can't speak. Or is it just word recognition and I see this and think the word can and suddenly that passes it on? And yeah,
there's a ton of there's a lot of exploration that could be done there.
Yeah,
if there's more books, I'd read them.
Oh, I'm looking it up right now because for some reason I thought there were, but
I can't remember for the life of me. I haven't read Pontypool, but there's a novella by him. I can see the cover in my head. It's like a marquee. I don't know. I remember really liking it, and I remember buying it from the cheesing guys, and he was like, this is depressing, and I was like, good.
All right, Matt, you go while she finds it.
All right, yeah, I'll go slightly more mainstream for this. I'll dip in the middle because I wanted this one really interests me because I love the movie and I love the book, but they're very different, and I feel differently about both, and that's The Fury.
Yeah.
And I love, De Palma is like probably my favorite guy, maybe him or Verhoeven. I don't know, but
similar. I see similarities between them for sure.
Yeah. And I adore both and I love The Fury. I think The Fury is a great movie. And the book written by John Ferris, who wrote the script for the movie, but it's really odd to me that he did because it's like, it's so different. The general story is kind of the same. But the first thing about it that was interesting is like, I would have cast Kirk Douglas as as the main character. Cause you read when you, in the book, he's very much like a kind of cold, calculating, almost like Daniel Craig's James Bond. Oh, okay. Like that's kind of the guy I kind of picture. He's like this real kind of edgy spy sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get to Kirk Douglas and he's super jovial, like, and it's just a weird, it's a weird kind of, well, I wouldn't have gone there, but,
what's that? Was that a De Palma decision to cast him, or do you think he came with the project?
Yeah, I don't.
That's something we'll try to look up, because.
Right.
That often could be a reason, right?
It could.
That's
be.
What got it greenlit. And that's why
you can make this movie with Kirk Douglas.
They watch Carrie and go, oh, De Palma can do this movie because of Carrie.
Right. Yeah.
But also, this is the John Cassavetes love fest, because now is. Another John Cassavetes
and,
film.
You know, it always, when I finally saw The Fury, I think the first time I saw it was like when it first came out on DVD. And I am going to spoil the ending. So I'm sorry, everybody. But
let me just say for the listeners, you can't spoil that ending.
No.
Because it doesn't matter if you describe it in detail, right. Watching
will
it
not.
Will still be special.
Well,
for someone.
You know, I won't even necessarily spoil it, but I will say that the my biggest question about the movie was, all these years where we spent time talking about the exploding head in Scanners.
Yeah, I know, right?
And
the Fury,
like,
one was
it's so
bonkers.
Good.
It's
so
and
good.
It's like, what?
Yeah.
Where, why have I never heard of this? But the interesting thing about the book is that the two kids that have the psychic powers in the book are a lot younger. Like, mm-hmm. they're really, really small, and it changes the story almost entirely, because it's like a really, it makes it like really sad and tragic, because mm-hmm. they're basically like little children that are kind of caught up in this awful sort of like psychic warfare thing, and they can't control what's being done to them, and the characters that are around them are kind of using them for their own purposes, and it just gives it a whole different thing that I'd almost see another adaptation of it, because it's like it is very different, and it's, I love both, but I don't know, they're so different to me.
Yeah, and also whenever De Palma's directing, you could give another director and it'd just be a different movie.
Yeah, because like De Palma spends so much time, and it's the best sequence in the movie, that escape sequence onto the street and stuff, and it's a corker, it's incredible. But like the somebody else wouldn't even go there. Like, mm-hmm. that wouldn't even be in that film.
Yeah. Or long tracking shots on the beach.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just people hanging out. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I love the De Palma aesthetic, but it's different.
It's a cool movie though. I think it's a really fun movie.
It is really good. It's I love it.
And Pontypool was a trilogy, but it was the only one in the trilogy that was actually about the virus that spread through language.
Oh, what the hell are the
other ones? Other two, they're about small Canadian towns that have other things going on.
Is that true?
But it's called the Pontypool trilogy.
Oh,
all books.
Amazoning these the second.
Yeah, it includes, it's literally his first three books. It includes Hellmouse of Bewdley, which is actually a short story collection. And then the second is Pontypool Changes Everything. And then the third is called Cesare, and it's about something mysterious in a small town that causes the residents to start experiencing insomnia. And this sounds nuts, because as I'm reading this, I see the words dwarf, doppelganger, and neo-Nazi environmentalist pushing kitty snuff porn on town.
Excuse me?
Okay. Well, then.
All right,
so that's the third one.
I think that book has the wrong title. Nothing about that makes me want to read that title, but man.
So, that's the third inclusion in the Pontypool trilogy.
And now that you say that, I will say that John Ferris wrote two sequels to The Fury that I have not read. So
I'm should have directed more movies, though. John Ferris. Dear Dead Delilah. I like that movie.
Oh, yeah. That's
a good
picture.
I like
that one, too.
Yeah.
All right, you're up, Adam.
Okay, I'll mix it up. I'll go a newer one. And it's one that Aaron actually kind of mentioned when he was on the podcast with you guys. But I think of Lucky McKee's The Woman.
Oh, yeah.
More because it's interesting. It's an interesting approach to adaptation, because it kind of is and it kind of isn't an adaptation, because I know that Jack Ketchum and Lucky McKee had a very fruitful collaborative career towards the end of Jack Ketchum's career life. But it's a movie I like a lot, and it's they wrote it together. It's a sequel to it's a sequel to The Offspring movie, but it's also a sequel to Offseason, Offspring. It's like kind of the third in the trilogy if you're going by the books. It's the idea that like Lucky McKee would take the kind of driver's seat in the script, even though they're writing it together, and then Jack Ketchum would take the driver's seat in the novel, which is a short
but
novel.
There's
it's
a
like
weird,
almost like a novella.
It's a weird thing, because like the novel doesn't read as explicitly Ketchum-y.
It kind of does.
The Woman?
It does.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like
I've read Off Season. I can't recall if I've read the Woman novel.
It's maybe a little more plain spoken. Mm-hmm. It's maybe a little more like it's a little like, but it, I see. That's why I like. That's why I wanted to talk about it, because it's like, well, is this even an adaptation? Is it just two people telling the same story to each other? Yeah. Like the kind of humor in the film, and then the lack, like the Ketchum-esque lack of humor in the novella or not short novel. I don't even know what like what you would even call it, because it's not a full novel.
You can read it in like 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. It's a quickie, but it's if you at all like that movie, even if you're somewhat frustrated by that movie, which I Sean Spillane did the music. It, like I know the soundtrack throws people sometimes, even though I like the soundtrack a lot. I listen to it all the time. It's a movie I like, but it's just like I said, it's like dueling banjos in a way. It's a director.
They're different
projects. It's a director and an author literally going back and forth telling the same story, which I find fascinating.
That is a good.
And the movie has two tones too, because it has the dark, like the really horrible, the way things look and feel really gritty and real, and then the performance by the lead, the father and the family is like in this other John, not quite John Waters, but satirical,
I
love the performance by the dad, and that's very disturbing.
It's Sean, what's his name? He's in Deadwood. He plays.
He's a great actor.
He's
been in tons of stuff.
He's been in a lot of stuff, but that's his like lead. You know,
he's in Jughead too, I think.
Yeah,
which
he is
also
yeah,
set
he
in
is.
That same kind of world.
He's a more sympathetic character. Yeah, that. And he's just a real scumbag in The Woman, which is just interesting. And Pollyanna McIntosh is great in that film. And I cannot wait to see her
Darling.
Her sequel to this.
Darling. Somebody sort of
Aaron did. Yeah, yeah, Aaron, yeah. So I'm just waiting for. I think it like comes out this week. I'm waiting for the Blu-ray. I'm not gonna rent it. I'll know I'll buy that. So.
The next one I'll do is, I haven't seen this for a long time, but I really liked it. And I guess it just came back to Scream Factory. William Friedkin's The Guardian. There is some interesting stuff of the book, even though I haven't read it. I learned a few things. So I guess it was a really troubled production, but it was developed for Sam Raimi, and it was going to be, it was based on a book by somebody called, Dan Greenberg, and it was called The Nanny. And it was a vampire nanny. And Raimi was going to do something that was going to be like a little, it was going to have humor and, you know, all sorts of tones like he does. But then he went off into Darkman. And so Friedkin comes on knowing what this project is mostly a straight kind of nanny snatcher kind of story. And then Friedkin is going along, and then he's asking for rewrites. And then basically somebody introduces him to the idea of wood nymph types and druid mythology.
Who introduced that?
But apparently he couldn't let go. Like once somebody brought up druids and stuff, he suddenly went all in, and then he became obsessed. And this is – we're talking not like months before. We're talking about as production is moving, they are making major changes to the mythology.
The tree was a late addition?
Oh, yeah. No, this – so she is basically what they – I actually found there's a real term for this. It's a hamadryad, which is a hamadryad. I'm probably mispronouncing it, which is a Greek myth. Being that lives in trees, is like a nymph. It's bonded to a very specific tree, and they would do sacrifices to connect to the tree people. And,
so that was a late inclusion.
Yeah, it was. And a human sacrifice. And I'm trying to.
It's the whole punchline of the movie.
Yeah.
It's just also crazy because it almost makes me want to read this book, because I could also see a pretty cool movie about a vampire nanny. That sounds pretty good to me. They kept the parts where, you know, they looked up the references and the person never existed, and then it turns out other kids had gone missing, all of that. But this is a movie that I found, it was kind of in that Hand That Rocks the Cradle time period. And when I first saw this, it was obviously a big deal because it was Friedkin returning to horror.
I remember the ads when it was coming out.
I liked it straight away. Like it was one of those ones I didn't know had a bad reputation here until recently. And then I realized people go, oh yeah, that's junk. I was like, no. I found it like, I thought it was like, because I was probably like 12 or something, like this is a really sexy movie. And it's this woman comes in and just, you know, destroys this
family.
But it's a, you know, as a young person, you're just watching through that kind of guys. I think it's really interesting. And the wood and the trees. Do you remember this? The tree stuff?
I haven't seen this ever.
She's like, you know, part tree. And she's like literally bonding to the tree. And the effects are really interesting.
They're cool.
Yeah. You don't know that till pretty far
in. It's late in the movie.
Maybe the first half wasn't anything to do with trees. I mean, they could have started filming this thing. It sounds like a wild production history to this one. And maybe the new Scream Factory will have part of that story.
I was going to ask you if you'd gone through the extras. Because
I haven't even gotten it yet. So I've only seen this from VHS days, you know?
Yeah, no, it's just to hop along on your point. Like, I remember I didn't see it for a couple years because when it came out, it was savaged. It was like terrible reviews. And it was like, what is he doing? And, you know, cause his output until then, I think was kind of bulletproof. And when I saw it, I was with you, I was like,
it's a fun movie.
It's a bonkers movie.
Good effects. Really cool. And and it's an interesting film. I don't recognize many of the actors in it, but, Miguel Ferrer.
Miguel Ferrer has a small part.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Featured in the trailer heavily. Wow. She cooks, she cleans. What else does she do for Bob? You know, very
Miguel Ferrer delivery.
But it's cool because this is one that usually we would recommend. You couldn't see it. Now you can see a beautiful copy of it. So
that's not brand new, right? Because I remember I got the Scream Factory disc and I kind of just was like, I enjoyed it. I was like, oh, what a fun, little, gem of a movie. And then just this week I'd seen Cruising for the first time. And about halfway through Cruising, which is like a stone cold, like amazing movie, I had the thought of like, you've seen The Guardian 3 years before you saw Cruising. I had a little shame attack, but I like it for different reasons.
I have a feeling you'd really like it, even if you saw it in the past, but seeing it now because it's got hyped up Lifetime vibes mixed with really good practical effects.
Yeah, I have a feeling. Wow, that is a good point.
Yeah.
I definitely need to revisit it because I think I watched it like when I was in high school.
Probably
because that's
probably
forever.
Oh, speaking of Lifetime, Psycho Granny.
Thank you.
Love it.
Go Lifetime. So, they're fun. So next up, I'm going to do Fallen Angel, which is the book that Angel Heart is based on. Everybody knows – well, I like to think everybody knows Angel Heart, but I don't know if a lot of younger horror fans
do. Just don't spoil the twist just in case.
Oh, of course not. So Angel Heart – Angel Heart movie was from 80s. The book was written in 78, and the movie is a wonderful adaptation, I do have to say. It really does feel noirish. It really is kind of the detective. It's infused.
Is the book New Orleans or not?
Yeah, the book is New York and New Orleans. Huh? Same thing, where it starts in New York, goes to Coney Island for a little bit, comes back to New York. But that's part of what I think makes the book so much better than the movie in this regard. And granted, I love the movie. But the book has so much detail into kind of the environment of New York City, the environment of New Orleans, and kind of the people that he runs into, and it's infused. It reads like a noir novel.
It feels like a travelogue, kind of.
It really does, yeah. And it reads, it's so noir. And the book is way more graphic and violent and bloody than the movie is. Like, they definitely cleaned it up a good bit for the movie.
Which is
shocking. Which is weird.
Hard to believe given the orgy.
Yeah, the weird scene at the end. Yeah. But there's like one of the most brutal scenes in the book is he watches them sacrifice a group of Satanists sacrifice a baby on the subway. Like on the subway car. And so it's stuff like that, like just him seeing stuff around the city. And you get more moments of you get more clues in the book without saying what you're getting clues of. You get more clues in the book that kind of lead you in other directions. So it's a little bit more involved. The movie feels like a much more straight line of he was meant to kind of learn this information from the get-go. The book is a bit more meandering.
It's a bit more of a detective. He's really figuring
it out. He's actually got to figure it out, yeah. So that is Fallen Angel from 1978 by William Hortzberg.
And the film is by Alan Parker, and it's a classic.
It's amazing.
Like, if you haven't seen it, rush out.
It's Angel Heart, it's epic.
Agreed. I'm going to go with The Reincarnation of Peter Proud.
I've been dying to watch this one because it just got the Blu-ray, and it's one I've always heard about, never seen it.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous Blu-ray. Yeah. Thank you, Kino, because it's one that I've been like requesting for years. Yeah. It was one that I saw as a kid on like WLVI 56 and all the juicy parts edited out because it's definitely an R-rated movie. And the premise of it is basically this California teacher is just besieged by these terrible nightmares of him being murdered. And, there's a slight spoiler in the title. but it's this really great story about this guy kind of like solving this mystery. And the book's pretty close to this too. So I'm going to kind of talk about him as one entity. And it involves him kind of piecing together like the clues from his dreams. And there's a really great sort of like, he travels back to Western Massachusetts, which is where I'm, Central Mass is where I'm from, but Western Monster Mass, and so you get to see, like, this is directed by J. Lee Thompson, you know, and so you get to see, like, just seeing, like, J. Lee Thompson shoot Western Mass in the 70s is really cool, because it's like, I, you know, just seeing, like, parts of the state that I've been to, and just seeing it through, like, this lens is gorgeous. It's a movie that I think is sorely underrated and underseen, and I you know, if people that listen to this show haven't seen it, like, really, really check it out. It's a great movie. And the book's really good too. Max Elric, I believe, is the or Alric, it's not quite your name.
I've seen that more than in my name. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking
of literary adaptations, my name does come from the book.
Is that true?
You're
named after Mike Moorcock?
Dad was a big Michael Moorcock fan, and I've told this before, but my mother's first thing she gave me was this Elric comic book, because she was so, like, excited, and she gives it to me, and she goes away. I must have been like 9, and I open it. It's like got him having sex with his wife from behind, and I'm reading it as a kid, looking at these, like, she didn't even open the freaking comic.
But you grew up fast.
Yeah, my brain was like, what?
We all have to grow up fast sometimes. Yeah, that movie's great, and it's very, like, the book is great, because it came after, like, you know, Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist. So it's that sort of, like, that time in horror paperbacks where, like, horror was kind of obsessed with, like, occultism. And, like, when I think of the 70s, it's like,
I love that stuff.
Yeah. I think of, like, the kind of, like, the peace and love new aginess sort of morphed into this really, like, weird kind of, you know, nefarious occult stuff. And like, when I think of the 70s, I think of, like, you know, fondue and occult.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a really great story. When you watch it, I hope you talk about it, because the blue is really great. And it's an awesome movie.
It's a good reminder. I've been planning to buy this one, so I'm going to buy it and watch it soon.
All right, cool.
I'm going to go back to the Richard Matheson pool. The Last Man on Earth, the 64 nice adaptation of I Am Legend with Vincent Price, which I know is famously, I think Matheson himself wasn't the biggest fan of, but I think it's a movie. It's maybe a flawed movie, but it's for a book that's been adapted 3 times. It's if anyone who doesn't know the story, I Am Legend is the vampire book, the vampire plague book that is the base. You know, basically became the prototype of the zombie story too. So it's a twofer. But it's a book that I'd mentioned. I was for a number of years, I was a teacher. It was a book that, like, if I came into a school and I was like, can I have money for books to order stuff in the book room? I'd always order that, because kids, with the Will Smith adaptation, kids are very, like, want to read it. It's a high engagement book, but it's also a book where, you can teach about a lot of different things in a pretty, you know, straightforward manner. And it has teachable moments in the book, but it's a book where the kids get really into it. And as we're going along, they just get more and more pissed off. Like, they're like, this isn't like the movie. And they're like, but they'd be on the side of the book. They'd be like, they very much want to go along with you. Like, they're mister, this isn't like, and it's like, we'll see. Mm-hmm. And then I'd you know, finish up by, like, it's a quick book. And show them kind of snatches from each of the adaptations, where it's like some of this is representative of the book and some of it isn't. Like, you know, Last Man on Earth used closest to the book, but, like, the Charlton Heston in the Omega Man is, like, is closer to the Neville from the book. But even though the movie's not, like, even though the movie's not
the character,
close to
the
character, like, yeah. if you Franken,
that's cranky
if
Neville,
you Franken,
yeah.
Yeah, if yeah. you Franken movie, and if you even took, like, the Will Smith stuff, if you took with him and the dog, you could conceivably mesh all three of these movies together and, like, and find
a real
Legend,
adaptation.
I Am Legend in there. But yeah, it's a movie that, I have always kind of had a soft spot on for it.
I love the Omega Man.
Yeah. The Omega Man.
I like the Omega
Especially
Man.
Especially the way the vampires look.
It's cool design. Are.
I think they're creepy and weird.
Yeah. They're the best of the three. Yeah.
Those disco eyes.
I like a movie that also just got the Scream Factory. The book was called Thor. And the book was told from the dog's point of view, the entire novel, but it was adapted by Eric Red, but it was written by Wayne Smith. It was adapted by Eric Red into Bad Moon, which has a really badass wolf attack.
Werewolf
at the start.
Werewolf's amazing looking.
And it's fun because they still keep the
Thor dog in it and stuff, but it's not obviously told from the dog's perspective. But it's a cool family film. It, like, that's what I like about it. It's kind of like watching a family film, but then it is still really a hard horror film. But the family dynamics are interesting because it's not usually these movies are like the lover is the thing, but this is the brother. Yeah. And the brother returns to be with his sister and the sister's kid. And then you slowly realize it's Michael Paré, and you slowly realize, oh, he, you know, is going to turn into a lycanthrope. And, but the opening sequence is what I always remember. I just remember it's like two people having sex in the tent.
Yeah, it's a family
and
movie.
And a big fucking werewolf. We're not talking about a werewolf. We're talking about a fucking like 8 foot looking white weird werewolf, hacks into him. I just, that stuck with me for a long time. But I've always been curious about this book because of knowing that it's told from the perspective of dog. Have you read that one?
I have not.
I'm so curious about that. So, and also, I think of Hills of Eyes with the POV of the dog shot. No, Hills of Eyes 2, rather. Anyway.
Only you would think of that.
I have flashbacks myself to the dog's flashbacks. And I'm like, it gets complicated.
That's the weirdest thing is the dog here. Has a flashback. Yeah,
it's the greatest.
But this is a really fun movie. I'm a big Eric Red fan in general of his movies. And he's obviously a really good writer. He's a novelist too.
So,
watch that movie if you can, because I never, again, these are, it's funny, I haven't watched any of these on Blu-ray. I've only watched the first time I've seen them.
Well, I'm jazzed that they're finally doing Body Parts.
It's my favorite of all.
That's my favorite of his movies too.
I love that.
And it's long overdue to get it to get it.
Oh no,
to
it took forever.
I haven't seen it in forever. I can't wait to revisit it.
I know. I stand Jeff Fahey. So
and this is the best thing he ever did. I love this.
I don't know. Dwayne Duke might be. I don't know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I have a real soft spot for Psycho 3.
Yeah. No, but anyway, this one when they pull up to the light together,
that's true.
All right, Becca.
So I'm going to go Midnight Meat Train. Just because I always think that Clive Barker is somewhat in the same camp as Lovecraft, where his work becomes difficult to adapt unless you are Clive Barker, because it is so otherworldly and they always have this very distinctive look. And almost every Barker story, even his short stories, they will set up this elaborate mythos that goes along with them. I mean, Hellraiser being one of the best examples of it, but every single one of his stories sets up a mythos, and it's really hard to capture mythos on screen and have people go, oh yeah, I see, that's exactly how I was picturing it. But with Midnight Meat Train, I was able to go, okay, you know what, that's kind of exactly how I was picturing it. And the movie's fun. I just had a blast with it. And the special effects in it are super tight. And there are many other Clive Barker stories that I wish somebody would adapt to screen: Sex, Death, and Starshine. Jacqueline S. Last Will and Testament. Jovanka Bukovic was supposed to do for years. Mm. And I was so ready for that one. Midnight Meat Train would not have been my first choice had I just been like glancing through all of his stories. Yeah. Down Satan's another one that I can't believe nobody's adapted, but Midnight Meat Train would not have been my first choice just because it's so weird of like this guy has to kill people because there's creatures under the city that no one knows about and he has to feed them people to keep them at bay from killing all the people. And so that I'm immediately like, I don't know about this one. And I feel like there's other ones, but I'm so glad they did because this made me like the short story more.
I forget, does the movie have that?
Not the
underground.
The creatures? Yeah. Oh yeah, it does.
Does it?
Yeah.
I don't remember
for the life of me. I couldn't remember the ending of the movie. I'm like, no, I've seen it, but I know.
You see
how it
the
goes.
Creatures, and then it goes down to their realm. And I'm relatively sure that you see at least a glimpse of it through the windows. I don't think he doesn't like get out and like walk around or anything, but I'm pretty sure that you see a glimpse of it.
Yeah, I did like the movie, and it was. Remember that movie like was delayed forever.
Yeah,
and it was like
it must be a big release, right?
Yeah. Well, and then Bradley Cooper. It was like right before they dumped it right before he like. Kind of became like Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
I was like, oops.
Yeah. But the effects are really good in it. And the creatures look good. Like reading the book, it's always like, well, I don't even know how we're going to make these things look realistic, but they do. They're okay in it. Yeah.
And Bradley Cooper's like a photographer.
He's a reporter, I think. Photographer. That's it. And he snaps a picture of this weird man. And I think he ends up like trying to photograph the murders that Mahogany is committing.
So. I got to watch that one again. At the time, I wasn't that enamored by it, and I remember it being so the casting of the guy who was a famous soccer player as the
Vinnie Jones.
I couldn't get that, but I know he'd been in Lock, Stock, or whatever first. But
I got to
rewatch that one.
Yeah.
Last pick.
My last one. I bring it up only because I know that Elric is as much of a fan of it as I am. And it's interesting. I'm going to go with Howling 2. I'm going to open with Philip Mora, and I'm going to close with Philip Mora.
You guys are coming in with your parents.
Thematic.
And I want
your sister is a werewolf
in Australia. I want Aaron Dries to smile right now. Yeah. As Philip Mora. But this fascinates me because the movie's written by Gary Brandner and the book is written by Gary Brandner, and they are completely different. The book's interesting because it could be a sequel to Joe Dante's movie, or it could be a sequel to Gary Brandner's first book. It has no Queen Sterba, so it's kind of bullshit. But it's the character of Marcia, the kind of nympho werewolf from The Howling, the book and the movie, has survived the fire, and she and her lover who in the movie is taken from Dee Wallace, they've survived, and she has convinced this guy that they're gonna go kill the Dee Wallace character, which is Karen, that they're going to go and track her down and take revenge for what she did to the colony in the book. It's not the colony, but it's this really odd. It's like they kind of follow her around in this van and they just kind of like mess with her. and they're like trying to kill her. And it just ends up being this like weird, like escalation where they're both trying to kind of outdo each other. And, it's a really odd, but interesting sequel. And if you like the movie, The Howling, Joe Dante, you can actually read the second book and it kind of is like a follow up to it. Or you could just read all the books, but no, it's a really fascinating, and I'm fascinated by the duality of like you had Brandner, but yet what they came up with for the movie was one of the weirdest movies.
Yeah. And montages.
And montages.
Post-credit sequence that go on forever. The Civil Danny, the choices there are so bizarre.
The choices in the whole movie are odd. And I remember
Lee's glasses.
Christopher Lee's new wave glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Babel, the Steve Parsons band is great.
It's funny you say that because like the whole thing with Neil Blomkamp saying, I'll make a direct sequel to like the Alien films. Like I would love to have done that for the Howling 1 and just you start right as she's transforming live on air. And what would that do to society to see that? Right. And it could be a great movie.
There's a million different stories and none of them have tapped that. And I think that's actually, that would have been the one to go with.
Yeah. But that's an interesting choice. Okay, cool. Philip Mora.
Love him.
Okay. Well, it's going to be Clive Barker heavy.
Nice.
We're going to talk about Lord of Illusions, which is based on The Last Illusion, yes. The six books of blood, which introduces Harry de Moor. That's the first Harry de Moor story, correct?
Or not? I
know, but it's interesting because it's a character that he wrote.
Isn't Damnation Game have that character at some point?
Yeah, Harry
weaves into a bunch of stories.
Yeah,
he's
comes
like
up
a protagonist
in
others. So it's like kind of like it's this kind of constant companion to Barker, and it's he directed. Forgive me if I'm forgetting. He only directed three features.
Yeah,
correct.
He did Hellraiser, so Lord of Illusion, Nightbreed.
So this is the last. This is the last of the three, and I think it's the one. If you're just looking at him as a director, like versus, you know, adapting his own work, I think it's the one that taps into, kind of what Becca was saying, where there's a multifarious, kind of tone and that he has, and he'll kind of tap into different versions of himself. And I think it's not a film that I love, but
You only love it.
I like it. And I find it incredibly interesting, and I think it's a good movie. And it feels more finished than Nightbreed. Like there is a director's cut of this, and they're like Scream Factory put it out, and it feels like this is a whole articulation. So it's a movie that I really like, but it's interesting to see him. He's not doing monsters. He's not, or to a certain extent, he's not doing monsters. He's doing that kind of, you know, Cold Hard Canyon. Like he's doing that kind of noir Barker. Yeah. He's doing his adaptation of his own work in that feel. And it's a good watch before coming out here. It's a good like there's a lot of LA in it. And
I love the guy who plays the cult leader, the villain, the, whoever that actor is. He's so good in this. And I do find him quite scary the way when he becomes what he becomes.
I'm glad you mentioned Cold Heart Canyon. That's another one that I loved reading and would love to see it as a movie. And that one is so self-contained. I'm surprised no one has. It's kind of an updated version of The Changeling where it's just a dude alone in a giant house.
Cool. My last one is I just think it's a brilliant movie. I didn't know much about the novel, but it makes more sense why I did it. So, The Tenant, by Roman Polanski. And I think the reason why I'm interested in it is because I was always baffled by why Polanski acted in it. I mean, I know he's dabbled in acting, but it's a very strange thing, especially given his like public persona at that point in his life, to put yourself front and center in this movie. But reading up about it, it was based on a French novel called The Chimeric Tenant by someone called Roland Topor. And in it, it is so specific. The character in it was a Polish Polish person living in France who feels persecuted and slowly is driven mad and becomes. So I could imagine a Polanski. I could imagine being in that psyche where he is, and he's now purposely chosen to leave America forever. As a fugitive on the lam, and he reads this book and probably like totally identifies himself into this thing. It's actually a very interesting performance. But the movie itself, is to me it even looks a little bit like Possession of movies like that of that era, but shot, that's the DP, Bergman's DP, Sven Nyquist. We talked about it recently on the other show, but Pure Cinema, but it's a really interesting movie because unlike most of these movies, like if it was Possession or something like that, it's just about a guy who the routine of his day and where he lives is slowly making him believe he might be the woman who formerly lived in the apartment and jumped out the window. And you're like, that is so absurd. And yet, as it goes, you buy it.
It's sold, yeah.
It feels like a Harold Pinter play that's gone. It really has that absurdism in the dialogue and the way they speak. I can't. And the cool thing is, like when I saw this when I was young, I actually probably preferred it to Rosemary's Baby when I was young. Yep. Like I just totally. There's something about this particular film because I think it's a little less explained. But
very much.
But it's disturbing. I love movies that have horror like. Oh, here's a weird hole in my wall. I'm opening it up. Oh, why is there a tooth in the wall? And it's wrapped inside and not fully ever going to explain that.
Right.
And then it lingers with you for the rest of
your
life.
There's nothing you can explain. You cannot explain that.
Yeah. The tooth in the wall.
Right. Yeah. And it's also a Rear Window. It's a Rear Window play. It's a really good movie. I actually think I'd really like to read this book now because it's one I didn't even know was a literary adaptation until
me neither.
Mm-hmm. So it's always fun to get this. Figure that out. So did you have your last?
I got a ton.
No, you only get one more.
I only get one more?
Ernie's on borrowed time. He's been here a while.
Yeah. we're running out of tape. So then I'm going to go with my favorite on the list, which is Uzumaki and the film Spiral. I've not
seen it yet.
I've mentioned on the show repeatedly what a huge Junji Ito fan I am. But this was my gateway to him. Was I saw the movie Spiral and immediately went, this is fucking bonkers. And I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I have no idea where it began. It doesn't really have an ending. I don't know what's going on. It really doesn't. It's like you're seeing a snippet of like an hour and a half long snippet of this town going mad. And it existed before you got into here. And it's escalating throughout the course of the movie. And then the movie just stops. And you just know that it's continued in this absolutely weird pattern.
I haven't seen it. I've known about it for years, but never saw it.
There's people, I'll say that there's a lot of Junji Ito fans that don't love it. But there are a lot of Junji Ito fans that don't love the Tomei film either because they are kind of, more attached to the books. The books that it's based on, Uzumaki, was a manga that ran from 98 to 99. It may have been a little bit longer, but that's all it is it's just about this town that's obsessed with spirals to the point of driving themselves insane. And some of them hear voices from the inner ear, which is in the shape of a spiral. And so for some of them, everyone is trying to form themselves into a spiral in some capacity. So like a guy shoves himself in the washing machine so that a person gets caught in a tire. And they're all trying to achieve spiral as perfection. And it's just this madness that spreads through this town. And this girl who first sees it in her classmates, as they're just drawing spirals or, they're you know, curling their hair and things like that. And she just becomes grossly aware of all the spirals that are around. And then gradually it spreads to the whole town. And she's just watching. It literally is like an apocalyptic scenario of insanity.
You should read the, I just read the book for the first time. It does feel more than most manga that I've read. It feels like very novelistic
because
it really does start small and then it gets really big. Does the movie get that big?
The movie stays mostly in the town.
Okay.
I mean, the manga does blow it up, and the manga functions very much like Black Hole, where you're in these characters' lives and there's clearly some weird fucking shit going on, but they're just kind of going through the routine and know that this thing exists, and they're just kind of, you know, rolling with it, except for the one girl who's really seeing everything that's going on. So the movie does not blow it up as much. It mostly stays
snail
in this
people
town.
In the
There are snail people.
Oh, I gotta see this movie.
Yeah, there are snail people, and they look good. That's the other
Isn't
thing.
Isn't there an American film called Spiral? Was that not
there?
Like,
is
Adam Green,
right?
Adam Green
did
was
it.
That related?
No, not.
Oh,
in any
I just assumed it was a. Okay, gotcha.
I saw that one. I like that one.
No, this is Japanese. It definitely goes by the name Uzumaki as well, which was the same name as the comic.
Is this the one that's like not connected to the ring, but or am I thinking?
Oh, this is not connected to the ring in any way.
Wasn't there a movie that like that was connected?
I don't know.
There's like 18 ring films. I can't even keep up now. Okay. Like they keep those in the Grudge films. They just keep churning them out.
They keep making Grudge. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't even keep up with. For a while I was like, there is. Oh, but there is a ring film called Spiral.
Oh, okay.
There is. Because it gets.
Not crazy.
No, you're not. And that may have been. I watched a ridiculous amount of the Ring sequels. Like I made it through 12 of them, and there were some.
I've never seen more than like two.
My Arrow.
Oh my god.
Stops
they
at, like,
keep going.
Stops at zero.
And I watched. So I'm on the Arrow box set talking about the legacy of the Ring. I'm one of the talking heads. And so when I was prepping for that, I was like, I'm going to watch every Ring film. And I made it through like maybe 10 or so.
I can't wait to dive into this.
But yeah, there were some of the subsequent like later sequels that I was like, that was actually a really good movie. And then there were some that were just absolute garbage. But they were hit or miss. But no, it is not connected to this. Okay. That is a different thing. But there is a Ring spiral.
I'm sorry to
No, you're totally fine. But Uzumaki, I saw the movie. Then I immediately wanted to see the comics that it was based off of and read the mangas. I think there were like three big volumes of them that I binged. And then from there, that's what led me into everything else that Junji Ito had done and led me to all of his other works. So I will definitely plug that one.
Awesome.
Yeah, our friend Scott Cole like got me to read that, and I'm glad he did because I loved it.
It's not nearly, even though that there are snail people and people shoving themselves in washing machines, it's not nearly as body oriented as a lot of Junji Ito's stuff is. Most of his stuff makes my skin crawl the entire time, and I can't stop reading it, but it's just disgustingly, and not even Cronenberg way, but it's just like, you know, there's one about people's bodies. It's very Black Hole-ish, where people's bodies will just start forming holes and things like that. And it's so it's very body.
It's like those Facebook photos where you see the thing with the, like, you know,
I hate those.
They do creep you out. They look like shower heads. Those little
The little spore things.
Like, the trypophobia.
Oh, it kills me.
Talking this?
as we wrap, I want both of you just answer that. This is a quick fire because we're wrapping.
All right,
a book that really needs to be a movie.
Oh Jesus, you go. Headhunter by Michael Slade.
Okay.
Book that really needs to be a movie. I don't know. I'd say Feral by Matt Serafini.
Oh, you are so.
Oh, yeah, there you go. And now you should feel really bad.
I know.
But he got the Clive Barker.
What's yours?
Yeah, he's got the Clive.
I mean, there's tons. And if I say it, it'll be something I want to make. So
I'm going to go, just because I've said it on the show before, and I've now talked to him about how much I love it, Harrow County by Colin Bunn.
Oh yeah!
That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, I I'll tell you one because I love it, and I've told you about that. I'd love to make it one day. It's Kathy Koch's The Cipher.
The Cipher. Yeah.
I think that could be updated just slightly to a modern era, like the ending of video stores where they're closing, and it was like the last era of the video store about to close. Mm-hmm. I think those characters are great, and she's a really good writer. Yeah. So, anyway, cool. You guys, it was awesome that you guys made it onto the show. There could have been some twists and turns in our day that could have prevented it, but we made it.
Thank you so much.
No, it's super fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Look out, you can find your books on Amazon.
Yeah. Our names are probably in the right on your phone right now on the podcast description.
Yes.
So yeah, please throw those in Amazon. You can find her.
Read us.
Yeah, and Rob should be back next week. I assume we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.